This is Richard Perrone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Andy Roy. Today is March 13th, 2003. It's approximately 8:37 a.m. Central Standard Time. Mr. Roy, why don't we go ahead and continue where we left off about a month ago. We were talking about the aftermath of your initial fight there on Hill 724/668, and then we went into a road clearing operation, and you discussed going out into the woods by yourself. Why don't we pick up from there?
Okay, the squad had set up around the large D-10 Rome plows that were clearing the vegetation back from the road. It was either 100 feet or 100 meters.
Mm-hmm.
This made it possible for convoys to travel the road, and the enemy would not be able to get that close to them to initiate an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
Having to fire from that distance, especially any anti-vehicle or anti-armor weapons, such as an RPG rocket launcher,
mm-hmm.
The accuracy is reduced greatly. Also, convoys were generally accompanied by helicopter gunships, or at least a command helicopter that could call in gunships and artillery. And where the clearing stopped, the 100 feet or 100 meters from the road, created a very delineated line that must be where the enemy's firing, because
mm-hmm.
after doing all the plowing, it plowed up earth into kind of like a berm.
Right.
So the enemy couldn't fire from behind it. They had to be right on the berm.
Mm-hmm.
So you could direct your counter-ambush fire and the like very accurately, because you could figure out where the enemy was easily.
Mm-hmm.
We were set up in two-man positions around the plows. There was a tank with us on a small clearing
mm-hmm.
that had set up an anti-rocket barrier that armor sometimes did. They put these steel poles in the ground and kind of an arc around their front and around their rear, and had chicken wire so that if an anti-tank rocket was fired, it would hit the chicken wire and detonate a few feet in front of the tank,
mm-hmm.
which would disperse the explosive power and protect the tank,
right.
And then the tank would take defensive actions.
Mm-hmm.
So I got kind of bored. I decided that I'd go off for a walk in the woods,
mm-hmm.
The jungle as such. I told the guy that was with me and indicated to the positions way over on the left and right flank I was going to go out into the woods and just look around, and said, you know, I'll sort of go out and act like an advanced outpost while I'm out there. Basically, I just wanted some solitude, and I wanted to explore this very, very, very dense jungle, very primeval kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Was it okay for you to do that off on your own, or is that unusual for troops to go out?
Unusual.
Okay.
Especially in an area like Docto.
Mm-hmm.
To go out in front of your lines to relieve yourself is one thing. You let everybody know on either side of you, and you only go out, you know, not very far, just barely out of sight. But I went out probably about 200 meters and basically traversed all the way around the perimeter. Must have taken me, an hour and a half. I kept my bearings because I could hear I believe there were four of these large D-10 Rome plows doing the clearing, so I could, you know, I could hear their noise, so I knew basically where to head back to.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't encounter anybody, didn't see any sign of anybody, but it satisfied a lot of curiosity. I sat down for a while and just thought and the like, and then came in on the other side of the perimeter, which I shouldn't have done because I didn't notify the other side of the perimeter. I came out in between the positions,
mm-hmm.
And was noticed by one of the men in one of the positions, but he also noticed I was a GI. He didn't realize who I was at first, so I walked over towards him, then he recognized me,
mm-hmm.
And expressed a feeling he thought I was being kind of stupid, which he was probably right. But, you know, so we stayed there for the rest of the day,
mm-hmm.
and we were relieved by the clearing patrols. At the end of the day, a clearing patrol would come from the two points, the the large base camp at what we call Dark Toe 2, later became Ben Hatt Special Forces Camp, and the next fortified position down, which was probably 4 or 5 miles, they'd meet in the center just to do some clearing, and then sometimes they'd drop off ambushes on the way to try and catch the North Vietnamese planting mines or whatever. And then we went back with them to Dak Tho 2. And the next morning we were notified we're going to be making an assault, a Hellebore assault. And I believe, I'm not positive, but I believe it was off to the north of Dak Tho 2. And as we were waiting for the helicopters, D Company, what battalion? D Company 1st Battalion, I believe, or possibly 4th Battalion, my battalion, came in because when the infantry company who guarded the perimeter left, another one had to replace it. It had to be guarded at all times, the perimeter. and I saw them coming in, and I found out, you know, who it was, what unit, and there was a guy I knew who was in that unit. I had gone through parachute infantry training with, and his last name was Riley. And it was a while before the helicopters could fly back, get refuel, and link up with more helicopters, because the assault we were going to make was a large assault. It must have been probably 12 helicopters plus two or three gunships plus a command ship. So I walked down to where they had landed, which was on the airstrip that had been plowed out there, and I met a GI coming up, and they'd been out in the field for, you know, 3 weeks or so, and they were very dirty, bedraggled, tired, and I met this guy, and I says, I got a friend in your unit, and his name is Riley, and he's a mortarman. Which the MOS for that was 11C. For infantry, it was 11B. But they trained together because they would swap jobs. Sometimes the mortarmen would have to become infantrymen. And they operated right with infantry all the time. Each company had a weapons platoon, which had mortars. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I know him. And he said he was killed 3-4 days earlier by a short round from one of our 4.2-inch mortars, which is a heavy mortar. And I remember hearing of the incident, and it hit the command post of D Company and killed, I believe, about 5 guys. But I had no idea Riley was one of them. And I just remember being stunned. And the guy just looked at me and said, sorry. And then walked on with his company up the hill. He really upset me. It caught me by surprise. Riley and another guy named Riley, the three of us had been very close friends during that training period. So anyway, I went back up to where my company was. They were breaking down into what's known as sticks. Or the group of men that are going to get onto each helicopter as it landed, and they kind of get into position, so when the helicopters land, the men are right there. We already know the type of formation they land in and how many ships are coming, so it's for quick loading.
Let me ask you a quick question. Yes. How do you deal with that emotion? You find out one of your buddies has been killed, and then you turn right around and get ready to go right back out into combat. What do you do inside?
Well, it's traumatic, but it's not as traumatic as let's say in civilian life, because everybody knew it was a possibility. It was a distinct possibility. And in the heavy fighting around Dak Tho, again, which lasted for maybe 5 weeks, you know, again, the danger was even greater. The surprise, of course, because I was anticipating meeting Riley. I hadn't seen Riley since that training. And it was kind of dashed. The GI that told me about it, he was completely exhausted. I mean, he looked at me a little pitifully when he said it, and then he said, you know, he was sorry. And I mean, it happens. When a comrade gets killed, you have to kind of accept it and drive on. And like I said, it's not totally unexpected. Mm-hmm. It happens a lot in combat units.
Right.
In most wars, some wars like the Gulf War, the KIA rate was very low.
Mm-hmm.
In the kind of fighting we were doing, whole companies were being decimated, battalions.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing I could do except turn around and walk back up to my group thinking.
Right.
My train of thought was broken by something that I had seen, something that in the end, looking back on it, I saw only three times during my experience in Vietnam.
Okay.
Soldiers, and especially in Vietnam, where the average age was, they make these false accusations. The average age was 18. The average age was 17.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the average age for an infantryman was about 19 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
But still a young man.
Right.
And it was really very rare. I mean, we had disagreements or arguments,
mm-hmm.
but as far as coming down to a fist fight, that was extremely rare.
Mm-hmm.
And one suddenly took place as I was walking back up to my unit, in thought. And these two black troopers had gotten into a disagreement over something. I think I found out what shortly afterwards, but I don't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
And they got into a fist fight. Right away, everybody else jumped on them and separated them.
Mm-hmm.
It was really kind of, it was a no-no among combat troops. Because if that happened a lot, there would be a lot of unit disunity,
mm-hmm.
And it would really shake people up. I mean, it just isn't tolerated.
Right.
Emotionally by the men, and definitely not by the officers either,
mm-hmm.
Because we all have to stay together. It was very short, one or two or three punches, and, they grabbed each other, I think, and then they were broken up.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember being very surprised. But like I said, out of all the three tours, I only saw it happen three times, once in 173rd and twice on my last tour.
Mm-hmm.
That distracted me a little bit, and then I didn't get involved. I just walked on, kind of surprised at that, too.
Mm-hmm.
But also my mind was on the upcoming assault. Thinking of Riley. Mm-hmm. Right up until the choppers came in.
Mm-hmm. How many days rest had you actually had, basically, from...
We'd had about 5 days.
Now, was that typical?
Yeah, typical for, about once out of a month.
Okay.
3 days in the field. You had four companies in a battalion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was called Palace Guard.
Right.
Now, this wasn't really coming out of the field, because... You're coming to a very crude, cleared-off area, usually, not always, but usually on some higher ground,
mm-hmm.
for easier defense. It's cleared and the like. There are bunkers built all the way around it, and then there's artillery and communications and supply in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And each battalion had a fire support base, and the battalion commander was located at that fire support base when he wasn't flying around all day. The battalion artillery battery was there,
mm-hmm.
and the battalion heavy mortar battery was there. There may have been some other specialized units from brigade or division, some intelligence units, electronic intelligence, that kind of thing might be detached if they felt it was an important location.
Mm-hmm.
But it was usually circular in form. Some of the men on the fire support base, other than artillerymen or people who had to be constantly on the radios, they would sometimes help share guard.
Mm-hmm.
And the infantry had to patrol during the day constantly. So out of a platoon of three squads, sometimes you didn't even have enough men for three squads,
mm-hmm.
but you take turns going out and patrolling. There was always... usually three patrols at every minute during the day out going around, because you never let the enemy get close to you in force.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you can drive away observers, because the enemy would have you under observation all the time for intelligence purposes, and for maybe if they were trying to plan an attack, they may be looking for a weak spot.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, the main thing is you always patrol, even if you're just a company by itself. Always patrol, have OPs or outposts set out.
Mm-hmm.
You never, ever, 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 ever let the enemy get close to you in force.
Mm-hmm.
Those patrols and outposts sometimes were sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
It's better to lose them than it is the entire unit. A loss of firebase being completely overrun could be disastrous, from the loss of artillery firepower and command group and stuff like that. But most of the time, if the OP was attacked or if one of the patrols were attacked, they were able to break contact or fight off the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
With minimal casualties. You always took a random route. The enemy never knew. You know, you changed directions all the time.
Right.
So, but it was the thing was, you didn't have to hump that damn rucksack.
Mm-hmm.
9 hours a day. You were set up in one place. They gave you extra food. You could sleep at night. I mean, you still pulled guard, but you had a heck of a lot of firepower sitting right behind you. I remember my bunker position there at Docto 2. We had a dug-in tank right next to us.
Hmm.
And that makes you feel a little bit better.
I'm sure.
And your bunkers were a lot more substantial, so you could take heavy mortar and rocket attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Easier.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe once a month also, most of the time at a fire base, you'd get a clean set of fatigues.
Mm-hmm.
You might get to take a shower. Again, this is maybe once a month basis.
Mm-hmm.
And generally just do a little bit of relaxing from the stress of the unit being out by itself.
Mm-hmm.
Working extremely difficult. I just can't emphasize how heavy that rucksack was.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at some of the troops today in Afghanistan and the like walking, you'll see they walk kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
That's because of that tremendous load they're carrying.
Right.
But then, after about 5 days or so, and sometimes that would be changed periodically. It may be a day or so, kind of depending upon the tactical situation. And then you go back out into the field, and another company would come in. So they'd rotate this among the four companies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
And that's what, okay, we were going off rotation at this particular time. D Company was coming in. So anyway, I got back up to where the sticks were being organized. I found my squad, and the sticks are usually made up of men of the same squad. So
mm-hmm.
when you land, the squad is kind of like all together.
Mm-hmm.
If you have to split up the squad, then the rest of it would be in the helicopter right behind you or right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you land, you get out, you get down, the choppers take off, and you already know in which direction you're supposed to go. You create, again, a perimeter, and as more troops come in, you expand that perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
You're always ready to be attacked. Although a hot LZ, you know, with a lot of resistance, wasn't really that common. On this particular LZ, as we came in,
mm-hmm.
I didn't realize until after we'd been on the ground for 20 minutes, a man had been wounded. A sniper had fired and had shot off a finger
mm-hmm.
as his helicopter was coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody got off the helicopter except him, and they flew him back to the aid station back at Docto 2, and I didn't know anything about it, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we formed up, and we started heading off in the direction of whatever objective had been given to us. I was very religious then, a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
I had this little medal I used to wear, and it was a military version of a religious medal. This one's for Catholics,
mm-hmm.
and it had the Virgin Mary on it, and it said, "Mary, Mother of God, Protector of Paratroopers, defend us this march, that medal fell off my chest.
Really?
Or off from around my neck. Mm-hmm. Probably going through the bushes, something must have grabbed it. And when we set in that evening, I felt it was gone, and it really upset me
mm-hmm.
because it was like a talisman,
mm-hmm.
and I felt a little bit more vulnerable.
Were you talking to your friends about it, or did you just kind of keep it inside?
No, I think I kept it to myself.
Okay.
Rather than bring it up later and have it forgotten, about 4 months later, we would head after the Battle of Dak To, and after I'd gotten back from the hospital, I was called up to the command post. We were out in the field
mm-hmm.
by the company commander, and the company commander said, "Roy, is this yours?" And he had the medal in his hand, and on the back, "Oh, wait a minute, I must have talked to somebody about it." Yeah. But I also had AR scratched on the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happened, but there it was. And this was well over 100 miles away.
Wow.
And he said somebody in the rear in Tuiwa found it in one of the washrooms.
Wow.
You know, the men wash up and shave in
mm-hmm.
the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, to this day, you know, just no idea whatsoever how it got there
mm-hmm.
and how somebody associated it with me. It must have been in a battalion center.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I had talked to somebody about it. I don't know. But it was one of those really odd things.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, ironically, and I'll go on back up in Dak To again,
mm-hmm.
We had just set in. My position was located right by a huge mahogany tree that had fallen down, and this thing was about 8 feet in diameter.
Wow.
And we were able to dig underneath the trunk of the tree,
mm-hmm.
and the position came up under the other side of the tree.
Hmm.
So we had a ready-made overhead cover that would protect us against just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
And just then, word went around from position to position that A Company, 2nd Battalion of the 503rd,
mm-hmm.
had just been wiped out on a hill off to our southwest.
Okay.
And everybody's going, "Oh, my God." That was the same company that had been virtually annihilated in Dak To in June, on June the 18th
mm-hmm.
of that year. Was thinking, "My God, it happened to the same company again."
Mm-hmm.
So we had the word right away that first thing in the morning, it was already getting dark, first thing in the morning, we're going to turn around, go back to that LZ, and then we're going to be redeployed over to help 2nd Battalion.
Right.
A Company had been with two other companies from its battalion. South Vietnamese Montagnard Special Forces, along with their American advisors, had, on a patrol, had found a hill, and they had heard sounds of heavy digging.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd snuck in real close and realized that it was an extremely heavily large fortified position, and that it wasn't just for a company or so, that this was a very large, very important position. It was sitting right on the border.
Mm-hmm.
So the 2nd Battalion had been sent over to investigate it. They got to the bottom of the hill. There was all kinds of sign of recent use.
Mm-hmm.
So two of the companies got online and assaulted up the hill, while A Company remained at a flat area. It was on a ridge line that kind of went higher and higher and higher until you got to, and this was Hill 875,
mm-hmm.
And started cutting and blowing an LZ, because they knew that there was going to be casualties.
Right.
They knew they were probably going to be needing resupply and probably reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So while the other two companies are trying to fight their way into this extremely heavily fortified, dug-in position, I mean, this was one heck of a position. It had been fortified for over a period of 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
As I had related earlier, when We'd been up at Dock Toe before we went down to Tweewa, and then we're called back up. Mm-hmm. We were finding trails. We were finding way stations that had been made and left in their condition, bridges over rivers, positions already dug with cooking facilities, but they hadn't been occupied. They'd just been built.
Mm-hmm.
But by this time during the Battle of Dock Toe, senior command had realized that what we had been finding were the early stages of the plan for the Battle of Dock Toe,
okay,
which was to attack through Dock Toe down towards Kontum, and it was a traditional attack area
mm-hmm.
on the way to the sea.
Right.
It came out at Tuiwad. You could divide South Vietnam in two.
Right.
The North Vietnamese could not have carried it off, but it was a plan. While the two companies were attacking the hill, the one company, A Company, at the bottom of the hill on this flat area, started cutting an LZ. And their assumption was that the enemy was up on top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mistaken assumption. They didn't put out a solid perimeter. They were trying to get as many men as possible to cut this LZ quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a hard LZ to cut because there were mahogany trees up to 150, 200 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
Even as it was ended up cut, a helicopter couldn't come in at the 15-degree angle that they desire. They had to come in to this cylinder cut into the jungle and come straight down vertically and land,
mm-hmm.
pick up or let off whatever, and then go straight up again until they clear the trees and go away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that makes the helicopter incredibly vulnerable during
right.
that time.
Right.
Was
this a diversion, do you think, that they had the hill for, you know, appearance like you described, and then they're off waiting off the hill?
No, what happened was this hill was the command headquarters for the reinforced 1st North Vietnamese Division,
okay.
which was made up of three regiments of infantry, one regiment of artillery, and I believe there was a regiment of Viet Cong coming from populated areas approaching, but were cut off by Arvin troops
mm-hmm.
and turned back or destroyed before they could reach the area.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a reinforced division. And their first goal was to take Dock Toe. And then any follow-on divisions would come through, and they try and go through the passes to get down out of the mountainous areas where they could either hook a right for Pleiku or hook a left for Kontum,
okay.
Depending upon what happened. So that was the overall plan. This was their headquarters,
okay.
and it was situated right on the border. Now, the headquarters had been guarded by one company dug in on this hill, but this hill had been so fortified. They were roofed, dug in deep. They were roofed over with parts of mahogany trees. They could take direct hits from artillery.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't take a direct hit from a 500-pound bomb, but it was hard to hit directly or right next to where they were.
Mm-hmm.
They were connected by trenches and tunnels, and it was just amazing the punishment that they were able to take, and there would be an assault made and then just thrown back.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about pounding a heavily forested or jungled hill is when you do that, you knock down a lot of trees and branches
mm-hmm.
and you create obstacles for yourself.
Right.
So you can see even less further ahead then. But anyway.
But you didn't have much of a choice, though, did you, in that sense?
Well, no, you have to attack. The rule was the enemy was not allowed to keep any area.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a rule that was kept up until one of the last big battles of the war, which was LZ, oh God, it's with the 101st, 1971 or 72 in the Eschau. Anyway.
Well, what about the notion that you would take the hill and then get off the hill after a couple of days, and then the enemy would retake the hill? This is one of these things that historians
have written
about.
Well, it doesn't make any sense for them to retake the hill.
Mm-hmm.
But when we took the hill, we cut down all the vegetation so the helicopters could get in and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And then the enemy would be on that hill, and there'd be no vegetation to protect them from the bombs and the like.
Okay.
And besides, we having already attacked the hill, then knew the hill very well. So, you know, for the enemy to come back and take the hill, it just didn't make any sense.
I guess what I'm getting at is either the myth or the
reality. The old myth, yeah.
Yeah, that you know, you take the United States forces would take a hill and then abandon it a few days later, and I guess the enemy could do whatever he wanted to do with the hill.
Well, that's the difference between a guerrilla war and a conventional war.
Mm-hmm.
In a conventional war, the goals are to seize territory and destroy troops.
Right.
In a guerrilla war, the goal is to destroy the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't make any sense. You only seize and hold strategic land.
Right.
Okay? But the goal is to destroy the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just, well, like you said, it doesn't sound like it makes any sense unless you understand how this war is fought. And all kinds of guerrilla wars are fought this way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have a line, and the goal is just to destroy the enemy. And once you start letting the enemy own territory and keep it, then you've turned the initiative over to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do that.
What about the notion that another component of guerrilla warfare is that you have to convince the enemy in his mind that it's not worth the fight, that, you know, the more and more this goes on, the more lethal it'll get for him, more dangerous it'll get
right.
for him, and decreasing their political will, basically.
Actually, towards the end of the war, in our presence,
mm-hmm.
that was beginning to take effect on the North Vietnamese.
Okay.
But then, during the negotiations, we caved in.
Right.
We basically broke and ran, abandoned the Vietnamese, and I've already told you my
mm-hmm.
feelings of disgust over that.
Yes, sir.
Anyway, this 2nd Battalion, again, the two companies were attacking the hill. A company was down. They had just put out observation posts separated by maybe 30 feet apiece.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of a regular fortified line. But what was not known was that since this was a headquarters hill, that most of the elements of one of the infantry regiments of the enemy,
mm-hmm.
and it was either the 24th or the 174th, I forget, were guarding that hill and were down around the base of the hill. And their job was to attack any unit from the sides or the rear that were attacking the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people say this was an ambush. It was not an ambush. It was a maneuver fight. They didn't realize we had found the hill until 2nd Battalion started approaching the hill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that point, the enemy regiment, or there may have been just two battalions of them, whatever, but I think it was the full regiment, could see from their scouts which way, and there was one logical way, it was continue up the ridgeline,
mm-hmm.
Were approaching and swung around to one side away from where they knew that they would start to go up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And as the LZ's being cut, there's a lot of heavy firing and artillery going off on the hill. Men are chopping trees. They're attaching C4 explosive charges to the big trees and blowing them down.
Mm-hmm.
And the enemy were able to get in, close around on that thinly defended line, and then all of a sudden just attack in mass,
mm-hmm.
A human wave kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got just OPs and not a thickly well-defended perimeter line, that company had no chance. They were just overrun completely. A few men were able to get away, the ones that were closest to the beginning of the hill itself, and run up the hill. A few more men were able to escape due to the heroism of one soldier, and I'm trying to remember his name, if it was Lozada or whatever. He's either a machine gunner or he grabbed a machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to, from his position, hold off and kill quite a few North Vietnamese soldiers, allowing maybe 12, 13, 14, 15 more Americans to escape before a rocket hit a tree right behind him or right next to him, and he was killed by the shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
when I arrived the next day, our company, we passed by his body.
Mm-hmm.
So the men that were left fled up the hill to the other two companies, which were only halfway up the hill trying to fight their way into the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
The battalion commander suddenly realized he's surrounded on three sides. He's got the enemy sitting down and has just taken his perimeter and wiped out one of his companies virtually.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's got an extremely heavily dug in and fortified enemy position on the other side of him.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Vietnamese are starting to then, at the base of the hill, come up and flank on the sides and totally envelop the company.
Mm-hmm.
So the three companies of the 2nd Battalion had to form a perimeter on the side of a hill, which is not the best way to form a perimeter, not the best place to form a perimeter, and held off the enemy with a tremendous amount of artillery fire and air support. And they held them off all afternoon. Towards evening, it was just getting to be dark, and one of the last airstrikes of the day was coming in. And they were calling the airstrikes close to keep the enemy separated and the like and disorganized so they couldn't form up for a solid, decisive attack.
Mm-hmm.
And the aircraft was a Marine aircraft. Nothing against the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
But he was coming in at dusk, and you couldn't see that well. And the bomb was laid in the wrong position. It was laid just inside 2nd Battalion's perimeter.
Mm.
And I believe it killed most of the officers, most of the medics, most of the wounded, and blew a hole in the side of the perimeter.
Mm.
Now, had the North Vietnamese, besides killing all these guys, about 60, had the North Vietnamese realized there was a hole that now blown in the side of that perimeter,
mm-hmm.
they could have poured through, and we'd have lost the entire battalion annihilated.
Mm-hmm.
But the North Vietnamese have been taking a beating. Vast majority of bombs came in right where you wanted them.
Mm-hmm.
But the North Vietnamese had taken such a beating, and they hadn't realized what had happened. And it was dusk, and they were starting to pull back. They had been taking extremely heavy casualties themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the night that me and my unit had dug in under that big log, and the word went around that A Company had been wiped out, and the
mm-hmm.
next morning we were going to go to 2nd Battalion's aid. We made our way back to the perimeter. We were taken off, and we thought we were going back to Dock Tow 2 and then go to someplace near 2nd Battalion from there, but we didn't. We went to another fire support base on a very high hill
mm-hmm.
with kind of a saddle on it and a beautiful view of a little river valley.
Mm-hmm.
And we went there in Chinooks, large helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
And since it was a fire support base, they could land those helicopters safely there so they could carry a lot more troops quicker.
Right.
They got us there. They unloaded us. And another company, also from my battalion, and I forget which one it was. It may have been B or A. It wasn't D. Had been flown in also.
Mm-hmm.
So we started off in file, one company behind the other, heading for Hill 875. And we no sooner got off this fire support base when we started hearing sounds off to our right and our left, and the point element could tell that somebody was in front and continuously pulling back in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew, obviously, that there were North Vietnamese scouts. We also knew of the old strategy in guerrilla wars where you put a unit under assault and then wait to ambush the relief column.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going very carefully. We had flankers out. We were taking no chances at all. We weren't racing to their aid because we knew if we did, chances out, we were going to be ambushed. But we were making as good a time as we could. Along the way, we started going up and down hills. And we started coming across, we must have gone through or over maybe four or five hills, and you could tell there had been major hill battles fought there
mm-hmm.
within the last week or so. Because the hills were all torn up by artillery, there was equipment laying around. I remember we took a rest in the file on top of one hill, and I was looking around, and I could see this object look like a log, and actually I'd seen something similar too on the previous hill fight, 724/668,
mm-hmm.
And I couldn't tell what it was, but there was something about it. And then I suddenly realized it was a Vietnamese body with the arms, the legs, and the head blown off.
Mm.
And where artillery hits, everything gets covered by a fine dust,
mm-hmm.
and vegetation chewed up, surprisingly, in little itty-bitty squares.
Mm-hmm.
When they get blasted,
mm-hmm.
they go to these little bitty squares, slightly concave on each side.
Mm-hmm.
And I never could figure out the physics of that,
mm-hmm.
but... And then there was a smell, slight smell of burned fresh vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you could tell these hill fights were going on constantly around the Dock Two area.
Mm-hmm.
So we kept going. We'd stop when we hear the North Vietnamese scouts getting a little bit too close,
mm-hmm.
and we'd go out and chase them off.
How was this a silent march, basically?
Well, yeah, all marches... sound discipline was maintained,
mm-hmm.
but we knew that we were being very heavily watched. We also knew that by looking at the map, there was only one logical way to get to Hill 875. If you didn't follow this long ridge and you went down into the valleys and the like, it would take you 3 days to get there,
mm-hmm.
and there wasn't 3 days to spare. Also, you come down off that ridge, I mean, at least to your left and your right, and to a good degree to your rear, the land is steep,
mm-hmm.
so it's hard to be attacked. You have to worry about your front.
Okay.
And there was already a trail there, too, that Allied units had been on. So we went on. Occasionally we'd stop, we'd send out a patrol, try and chase off the North Vietnamese scouts. They wouldn't go very far. They'd always stay just out of where we'd pull in, and they'd pull back in close again. But we were being watched because they expected us. They expected help to be coming for 2nd Battalion. I remember one scene that's really, especially from that day, burned into my mind. We were going along the ridge, and the land went up a little bit to the right, and off to the left it went over maybe about 30 feet, kind of flat, and then dropped off steeply down towards the valley on that side.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little flat area, and it was a graveyard, and it had just been dug that morning.
Okay.
They'd take a strip of bamboo, and at the top of the strip they'd fold it so it formed a star, and then the bottom part of that long strip of bamboo they'd stick into the ground. And there must have been, 30 graves at least there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very quiet, very peaceful. It was a very beautiful little area.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, if you have to be buried in a battlefield or near the battlefield, it was a nice place to be buried. I can still, you know, see it so easily.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a little bit concerned about off to the right because the land temporarily went up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we went past this, swung around that high land, and then went up onto it, the higher land, I mean.
Mm-hmm. How often did you see these small graveyards?
You'd find graves all the time if there was any fighting around. They went to great extremes, just as we did, to recover the bodies of their comrades.
Okay.
A lot of times people tell you that it was done so that we'd never know how many we killed of them, but that was a secondary reason.
Okay.
The primary reason is that men in combat, you know, you don't want to leave a comrade out there rotting.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you have to, especially the enemy. The North Vietnamese, but they did their best to recover their dead, and especially, of course, their wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't uncommon at all.
Okay.
So we continued on, and just as it was starting to get dusk, we came into a, had to have been at least a battalion size base camp.
Mm-hmm.
And there were dug-in kitchen areas and hammock areas and little bunkers. And it had been occupied very recently. And my guess to this day is that this was one of the positions where part of that regiment guarding Hill 875 had been set up.
Mm-hmm.
The regiment probably been split up into three battalions.
Mm-hmm.
And then when danger came, they'd come together to form a larger force. And it's starting to get dark. It got dark. We expected to set up as usual. But the situation was so crucial that when it got dark, it got pitch black. I mean, just literally pitch black.
Mm-hmm.
And inside triple canopy forest, I mean, you literally can't see your hand 2 inches in front of your face.
Wow.
So we had to hold on. You put your rifle with the sling over your shoulder and the rifle slung perpendicular to your body,
mm-hmm.
With the butt to the rear, the muzzle to the front.
Mm-hmm.
And the man behind you would hold on to the butt of your rifle.
Okay.
And then you'd hold on to the butt of the rifle of the man in front of you,
mm-hmm.
because if you didn't, there was no way you could continue without getting separated.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happened was us and the other company with us, and I'm still thinking it's B Company, did get separated somehow in the middle of that night march.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up taking a slightly different route. We knew we were separated, but the situation was critical. Keep going.
Okay.
The order was forward. And as we went on, the moon came up about, 9:30 or so, maybe 10 o'clock. And it was a full moon. And it was bright. And all of a sudden, it went from darkness to this glow of heavy moonlight,
mm-hmm.
which you could hardly see through the trees. And I remember we're going along, and suddenly I looked around me, and I could tell I was in an area where a lot of people had been,
mm-hmm.
because the grass and the brush is trampled down. And I expected it to be another abandoned enemy base camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the column slowed down real slow. I should say the file, company file. And no word was passed back, but it slowed down. And, of course, everybody became a little bit more alert when you can tell you're in an error or somebody had been recently. And we stopped for a second, and I remember looking forward to my right front. And right along the trail, I could see what at first glance looked like a log laying there.
Mm-hmm.
But the log wasn't that long. And at second glance, I could tell suddenly it was a body. It was just a dark shape. And then by the size of it, I knew it was an American.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a Vietnamese. So we continued, and it thinned out more and more and more. And suddenly off to the sides, you could see other bodies laying there. And then we came out into an open area, and this was probably the LZ that A Company had completed three-quarters of.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember there was still some little fires burning in the tree, especially in a bamboo that would pop or snap a little bit. And the scene was completely filled with moonlight. There were bodies everywhere scattered. There were rucksacks on the ground. You could tell they'd been rifled through. You could see little groups of Americans, and it looked like they had formed a little circle to make a final defense,
mm-hmm.
because the attack had come in from three sides.
Right.
And it's one of those, again, this is one of those things that's just burned right into my mind. We could tell, we knew instinctively this was A Company, 2nd Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
We made our way slowly through it. I remember seeing trees half cut down. I remember seeing trees with C4 explosives,
mm-hmm.
still attached to them,
hmm.
that were getting ready to blow them.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a little depression on one side, and I found out later on that was the command section. The company commander, the communications, the head medic, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
and their bodies were all there. Again, all the rucksacks had been rifled through.
Mm-hmm.
All the weapons were gone. A lot of the bodies were turned over face straight up because you could tell they'd been rifled through.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely eerie feeling.
Yeah, this is at night in the moonlight. You're seeing this and
right.
walking amongst all these dead bodies.
Right.
Did you guys talk? Do you just stay silent? What's happening?
No, then no talking.
You
maintain discipline.
Okay.
Now, here's where they kind of screw our guys kind of screwed up again, our leadership, and they did this a lot. A lot of times, we were never told what exactly the situation was. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some theories of military leadership prefer it that way. Other times, a lot of other theories say you should let the men know as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our assumption, the basic infantryman, was that this battle had taken place and that, as usual, afterwards, the enemy had taken off.
Right.
Well, that wasn't true. The enemy was still there. But it was dark. The North Vietnamese regiment, very seriously decimated by that time, was still around, but they were licking their own wounds, taking care of their own wounded, pulling off their own dead, reconstitute. Imagine a lot of officers and sergeants had been killed or wounded, so they're reorganizing and resupplying.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't bother us at all. We went up the hill a little ways and came into the perimeter
mm-hmm.
of 2nd Battalion, and then right behind us, from a slightly different angle, came B Company, the
right.
company that had been with us and separated.
Mm-hmm.
And we were exhausted. I mean, we were just totally exhausted. The things we'd been through, the things we had seen, had just mentally exhausted us.
Right.
We set up, and our impression was that we were inside the 2nd Battalion perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, come to find out, we weren't. And we assumed we were being given a rest. Nobody had to pull guard. So nobody pulled guard.
Wow.
The North Vietnamese had known it. They could have walked right in on us.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they had their serious problems.
Mm-hmm.
So we woke up in the morning, found out what was going on, and started digging in right away.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started receiving very, very heavy mortar fire, 60-millimeter mortar, 82-millimeter mortar, and 120-millimeter mortar. Which is heavy mortar.
Mm-hmm.
And then supposedly there's also some artillery coming in from Laos. I don't remember hearing any artillery. Well, it's hard to say. There's so many of our artillery rounds coming in. You hear them passing overhead and impacting
mm-hmm.
someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But we started getting extremely heavy mortared. And when the first mortar attack came in, it walked. They knew exactly where our lines were, and they walked right up the line.
Wow.
And I remember hitting it beginning down to our left, and just wham and wham. We heard the tubes firing at first.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a dung, 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 and those are the tubes firing. So you have that split second to get down.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us got down, grabbed our rucksacks, pulled them over our backs, and curled up underneath,
mm-hmm.
or if you could slide up next to a tree or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they started impacting, and about the third round, I heard this guy screaming, and he was screaming, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God, help me, oh, my God." And it was a horrible, terrible scream.
Mm-hmm.
I'm envisioning, you know, he's looking at his entrails hanging out or his arms been blown off or
right.
something like this. And it just echoed, and it was a scary, demoralizing sound for
right.
everybody.
Mm-hmm.
The mortar rounds walked up the line. They went right past my position.
Mm-hmm.
We started digging in even deeper. Luckily, it was this nice orange clay that was easy to dig into.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd have to stop periodically because then the mortars would come back in again
mm-hmm.
and go down the line, sometimes starting from the other direction.
How much artillery support, American support, was coming overhead to counter this?
During the whole battle, 105,000 rounds.
Wow.
Plus airstrikes.
Okay.
Because this 5-day battle now.
Okay.
So we're digging in. Finally, we got completely dug in. It took about an hour and a half because we kept having to stop when we were getting mortared or rocketed and get down. We got the land cleared in front of us, and different companies were taking turns trying to assault the hill. Our turn hadn't come yet. I have some photographs. I had my camera in a first aid. I had a little Minolta camera, 16 millimeter, and I had it in a first aid pouch. And I have a few photographs taken on Hill 875. Unfortunately, in my rucksack, I had like 9 rolls of film covering the previous parts of the Battle of Dock Toe, plus down at Dock Peck, the first big operation down at Tui Wa, the Dock Siang, which was north of Dock Toe. When I was wounded later on that day, I never saw my rucksack again.
Oh, really?
And I lost all that film.
Oh,
and that I had some great footage. But anyway.
That's too bad.
Excuse me. Finally the word came down to get ready because it was our turn to assault. And that's always a great anxiety provoker.
Right.
So we formed up. Another company came in, took over our positions, and I don't remember who they were. Just before that, some of the survivors of A Company 2nd Battalion came by. And I remember one guy asking him, how many men did you lose? And I said, we don't know. We have no idea. But it was just, and the way he said it was just bunches and bunches. Actually, I believe it was about, they were already, after heavy fighting, they were probably already down to about 100, maybe 110. I don't remember the exact figures. They probably lost about 80 out of that amount.
Wow.
And then some of the men that got away were wounded. But and that's considered annihilation.
Right.
For a battalion, for a unit. So anyway, we went over, we got online, we were working our way up the hill along a trail, and then we were going to take over the line from the company that was there, and they were going to pull back.
Are you carrying an M16, or do you have a...
I was a rifleman at that time, yes.
All right.
And I remember getting up to the area right where, just before the enemy positions, which you couldn't really figure out exactly. The they were so well hidden in camouflage, plus all the blown down vegetation. And this one area in between, you know, the lines have been hit so heavily, it was virtually open. Just stumps of trees and the like. And we worked our way up, I remember, at a stoop, and there were mortar fire coming in. Our artillery was still hitting. Even our own shrapnel was flying back on us. And I stopped by a stump that was maybe 3 feet high of a big tree, maybe 3-4 feet in diameter. And everybody suddenly got online and started firing. And we're firing and firing and firing and firing. And I'm firing. And you fire usually low, down to the ground, to try and hit at the base of bushes and trees because that's where the enemy's located. And you should be always aiming your fire, of course.
Right.
Well, I'm firing single shot, semi-automatic, and all of a sudden, everybody on our side stopped firing. I don't know why. It's as if somebody gave a signal, and I don't remember anybody. And I just replaced magazines, and I'm firing in this one area before I realized I'm the only one firing. Well, the object had been to get fire superiority, and that's where you've got so much firing going out towards the enemy that they can't even stick their heads up.
Right.
And when you can get that fire superiority, you know you've got it, that's when you start firing maneuver, which means every other man gets up, runs forward, maybe about 10 steps, flops down on the ground, starts firing, the men who were laying down firing where you advance, they get up, mm-hmm. go past you 10 steps, mm-hmm. they get down, they start firing.
Right.
And then you get up, and usually you're reloading your weapon while you're on the run, and you do this leapfrogging.
Right.
And that's a fire and maneuver assault, and that's the best way to do an assault.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get right up to the enemy, just about everybody throws a grenade, and when all the grenades go off, then you just charge right into the smoke.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm firing, and everybody stopped, and I guess when the bullets stopped going over their heads, the North Vietnamese popped up their heads, and the only thing they could see firing was me. And next thing I know, this tree stump that I'm behind
mm-hmm.
is catching bullet after bullet after bullet. I got down, and the bullets, the tree stump had been so shattered and alike, a few bullets actually came through, especially on the sides where it's thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hitting down low, and I remember I'm just crouching down lower and lower and lower and lower and just hoping that some North Vietnamese doesn't have a 51 caliber machine gun,
right,
which would go right through that.
Mm-hmm.
So after about a minute of that, and there must have been at least 200 rounds, either hit that stump or go right past me, the firing stopped. And I remember looking around, and everybody's looking at me on my side,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking at them wondering, well, what the hell did you stop shooting for?
Right.
But there was no time for communications.
Mm-hmm.
So we advanced at a crawl to try and get into a better online position, and just then, a sergeant called me over to the left, and I didn't recognize this sergeant, and I think he was from the unit that we were replacing on the firing line.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, get over here. And I said, I can't. I'm with my unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, God damn it. I said, get over here. We have to get this man down the hill or he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wounded man.
Okay.
And he was laying on a poncho. He was unconscious. And when you're carrying in a poncho, it takes four guys.
Right.
If you have a stretcher, you can sometimes do it with two. Sometimes, depending upon the size of the individual, it may take four. And an unconscious person or a dead person,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why, but they weigh more.
Okay.
I've heard that when they're conscious, they can move their body in ways that help. But
mm-hmm.
I go over there, and I grab a corner of the poncho,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly I realize, wait a minute, we're going to have to stand up at a crouch at the least to carry this guy.
Right.
Which means we're going to be exposed. I'm thinking, oh, God. So the sergeant says, take him. So we all lift, and we're at a crouch.
Could you have requested suppressing fire at that moment?
Excuse me?
Could you have requested some suppressing fire at that moment? Or were you just basically, let's get this guy and go?
No, I was basically just taken away from the unit, and mm-hmm. there was firing going on back and forth.
Right.
And I was dreading standing up, as I'm sure the other three guys carrying this guy were.
Right.
And we got up, and we went at this bent-over run,
mm-hmm.
which isn't easy when you're carrying a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be able to advance 20 feet and then have to get down for a second. The first move we made, some bullets went by, not extremely close. The second move we made took us a little bit down the hill, so it was kind of over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the whole hill on our side is constantly being mortared, and the rounds are going off in the trees and the shrapnel flying around.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us several of these 20-foot runs before we have to stop and let down. I can't truthfully tell you whether the guy was dead or alive
mm-hmm.
When we got him down to the LZ. One of our units, the 4th Battalion, had taken over the LZ and finished it and established the main aid station. And helicopters were now coming in to pick up wounded, drop off ammunition, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The anti-aircraft fire was so heavy, I believe there were 16 helicopters shot down around Hill 875.
Wow.
Which is quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I started back up the hill, okay, I'm going to get back with my unit, and there's another sergeant. Mm-hmm. Well, he hands me ammunition, machine gun ammunition and M79 grenade ammunition. And he says, take this up with you and then help bring more wounded down. You're with us now. So, okay, I got to work with him. So I carry ammunition up the hill, and then I'm helping carrying other wounded down, and back and forth and back and forth. I remember on the way back up one time, I was carrying water bladders. Mm-hmm. They were like long sausages mm-hmm. made of several layers so that they could be kicked out of a helicopter mm-hmm. from about 30 feet and hit the ground and not burst open.
Okay.
And one thing about combat is you get extremely thirsty very quickly, and that's due to stress.
Mm-hmm.
I was going up the hill, and I looked over, and on a bunker off to one side was the guy that I'd gone through parachute infantry training with. His name was Mann,
mm-hmm.
and he was an RTO. And so I just said, I was exhausted. I said, to hell with it. I went over and sat down and said, how you doing, Mann?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, good. He was in B Company 4th time.
Okay.
And there were mortar rounds hitting in the trees, but now it had just become so common we didn't even duck or flinch unless it was, like, right over us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're exchanging words. He told me that somebody I respected an awful lot in training, and I knew he was in B Company, a black man by the name of Grissetti had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, Jesus. And then he told me some of the guys that had been killed and wounded. At that time, we looked off to our right across the trail from another set of bunkers, and there were a couple of male reporters. And they were running from one bunker to another, and they were scrounged over, mm-hmm. and they had pistols held up. Their arms were bent up, and they were holding the pistols, and they were running like there were bullets flying right over their heads.
Okay.
Well, like I said, there were mortar rounds going off on the tree, but we were so used to it. And we thought it was kind of funny,
because
mm-hmm. there was no reason to be running. And they'd scoot from one bunker to another.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a lot of respect for reporters. There was a female reporter on the hill. Women always get respect. I don't care if they're trial lawyers. They get respect.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see her on the hill. I saw her the next day when I was in the hospital. But
how often were reporters around your units?
Thank God, not all the time. We really didn't have a lot of respect because they put the negative swing to things.
Mm-hmm.
They'd either over-dramatize, under-dramatize, get the information all wrong, but always the negative accent on everything.
Okay.
To the point where we just didn't want to see them.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones we didn't mind... reporters from real small town newspapers,
mm-hmm.
and they're mainly looking for a homeboy
mm-hmm.
just to give a report on. And I remember one guy, I don't know if you remember Boys Life magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I remember that reporter. And he wasn't interested in anything about the politics or anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't mind people like them.
Right.
But the other reporters and the questions they would ask, you could tell they were always looking for something negative.
Okay.
You know? So we generally... of course, you always have the people with egos that want to boast, but generally we didn't like reporters around.
Okay.
So anyway, I talked with Mann, went back up the hill, carried down another wounded guy, was carrying ammunition back up the hill, and Father Waters, who was the battalion Catholic priest,
mm-hmm.
Had been brought onto the hill, and he was given last rites to soldiers who were dying.
Okay.
And he was coming down the hill, and his robes were made out of camouflage parachute material.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't wear the traditional black and white.
Mm-hmm.
And as we went by, guys would reach out to touch him,
really?
Just to touch him.
Mm.
And it was like even, and I think a lot of these guys probably weren't even Catholic. You know,
right.
They could have been Protestants or Jewish even.
Right.
You know? But they'd reach out to touch him, like somehow there's some sort of salvation, you know, through to God from God through him.
Mm-hmm.
I remember feeling very good after touching him.
So you did it?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was killed the next day,
mm.
giving last rites, and a mortar round landed right next to him, and he was awarded the Medal of Honor.
Mm.
But Went up top of the hill again, carried down another wounded. It was starting to get dark. And I said, to hell with this. I'm going to go back, find my position that we started from, where my rucksack was. I'm going to get some food, some water, and the like. And then I'm going to work my way back up the hill, and I'm going to find my unit and join them for the night.
Mm-hmm.
So I started walking around, and it was getting a little dusk, not real dusk, but, and I was trying to figure out which way the line went.
Mm-hmm.
And I come to this one position, and there were three guys there. One guy was sitting on top of the position, and I clearly remember this day he was eating a sea ration can, and it was turkey loaf.
Okay.
Which wasn't one of the great favorites, but mm-hmm. it wasn't one of the most horrible things either.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two other guys standing in front of the bunker. And I asked them, I said, it looks like the line has changed a bit. Which way does the perimeter go now? And they pointed in one of the directions.
Mm-hmm.
So I started the walk. I took about two steps, and I was in between the two guys that were standing in front of the bunker facing the guy sitting on the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard what sounded like a far distant explosion. And all of a sudden it was like Babe Ruth had stepped up behind me with a baseball bat
mm-hmm.
and hit one of his greatest homers. I felt the impact. I knew instantly what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been hit. I was picked up off the ground. The ground was sloped, thrown forward, and when things happen like this, car accidents, things like that, things kind of go in slow motion, they
mm-hmm.
say.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember flying forward towards this big mahogany tree about, oh, I don't know, 3.5-4 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going face first, and I consciously, in midair, turned my body to the right and slammed into the tree, into the tree with my shoulder,
mm-hmm.
and then my rest of my body came forward, slammed into the tree, and I fell off to the left, bounced off to the left, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the next thing I knew, I was laying on my stomach.
Okay.
Wherever my helmet or my weapon went, I have no idea. And I'm laying there, and I realized I'd been hit, and I knew I'd been hit in the back,
mm-hmm.
and my first feeling was, oh, my God, my lungs might have been punctured.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in actually the right scapula.
Okay.
I knew I wasn't worried about the heart, but I took a deep breath and let it out, and there was no problem, so I knew the lung was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the panic suddenly went to elation. I realized, great, I've been wounded. I'm getting the hell off this hill.
Mm-hmm.
I'm even going to sleep in a real bed tonight.
Hmm.
Of course, I had to worry about getting off the hill first.
Right.
I turned off to my right, and the guy that had been standing there was laying on his back, and he was dead.
Okay.
He had taken severe wounds in the chest and what was very apparent in the face and the head.
Mm-hmm.
I looked off to the left, and that man was laying on his face, and it was an awful lot of blood from around his head
mm-hmm.
that I could see. And I just knew he was dead. I made a slight twist to the back, and here's that guy sitting on the bunker.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a spoonful of turkey loaf, and it's halfway to his mouth, and he's frozen.
Hmm.
And he's just looking at me. And I said, I'm hit, man.
Yeah.
And he said, I know. And then he just didn't do anything. And I said, I'm hit, man. And he said, yeah. And then all of a sudden I got angry. And I yelled at him, God damn it, I'm hit. Will you go get a fucking medic?
Uh-huh.
So he says, okay. And he puts down a turkey loaf and he runs off. And at the time I was wearing what's known as a jungle sweater.
Mm-hmm.
Because up in the mountains it gets cool.
Mm-hmm.
You can see your breath. Up in the mountains
mm-hmm.
at night in Vietnam. And it's a very, very, very thin poplar or thin cotton sweater.
Mm-hmm.
You'd never wear it down in the lowlands. But sometimes we take off our jungle shirts, put on our jungle sweaters. I was wearing my jungle sweater with my fighting gear on over
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember, I really can't can't remember how long it was. It seemed quickly, but it seems almost too quickly from my memory.
Okay.
The guy arrived with a medic and another guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the medic said, "Where are you hit?" And I said, "In the back." And he looked, and he said, "I don't see anything." And all of a sudden, my heart dropped down. And I thought, "Oh, God, that was only concussion that hit me." Well, then he takes the bottom of the sweater, and he lifts it up,
mm-hmm.
and he says, "Oh, shit."
Oh, God.
And then all of a sudden, I'm thinking, you know, he's seeing this thing going boom, 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 boom,
right.
in this big hole in my back.
Right.
And he says, "Well, you got a huge chunk of shrapnel. It went in at an angle, and it's under the skin, but there's no bleeding, and it hasn't penetrated inside."
Hmm.
Well, great. Then I become elated again.
Right.
So,
were you in any pain?
A deep throb, that's
okay.
all.
Okay.
Where I had hit the tree, actually, I hurt more along my whole right side from where I hit the tree.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hit my face on the tree, luckily. So they helped me up. They didn't have a stretcher. And one guy on either side, they helped me down to the LZ. And I was very hard to walk on my right leg, right side.
Mm-hmm.
They sat me down in the ambulatory section. And during the battle, they actually brought in a surgical team of doctors and male nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And this was extremely rare. But this was a big battle. And they set them up right on the LZ,
mm-hmm.
and they did triage right there.
Okay.
Ambulatory one area, guys that if they can wait to get them into the rear, they'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Guys that either we operate on them right now or they're going to die. And then, of course, guys that didn't have a chance.
Okay.
They were put off to one side. And then there was the area where there were bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Helicopters were coming in, and every time a helicopter would start to hover down that huge cylinder, the North Vietnamese would mortar the place, and everybody had to get down.
Mm-hmm.
But those ships just kept coming in.
These were the dust-off guys.
Excuse me?
These were the dust-off guys?
Actually, there were so many wounded and the like, they weren't using just dust-off. Just regular slicks were coming in.
Anybody who was available?
Anybody, right. And
okay.
I've done that when I was a slick gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a dust-off, we were closer than a dust-off.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't make any difference.
Right.
Just get the guy out of there.
Right.
So luckily they never did hit a ship on the LZ, because if they had disabled that LZ and it was only one ship LZ, we'd have been in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have had to cut another LZ. But so I had a friend come by, a medic, Dr. Cortinas, I believe it was, and he looked at me and he says, "Does it hurt?" And I said, "Well, it throbs." He says, "Ah, what the hell? Here's some morphine." Whack.
Hmm.
He gave me some morphine.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, another guy come by, and I knew him slightly. He recognized me. He didn't know me real well. "How you doing?" You know, and I said, "I'm okay."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "You in any pain?" I said, "Well, not really." And he looked. The first medic that deals with you puts a tag on you,
mm-hmm.
through a buttonhole or on a belt loop or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it says when you were hit, how you were hit, what time you were hit, and what time and what type of medications were given to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, when a doctor or another medic got to you, they knew not to give you the wrong medication or too much of a medication.
Right.
So he looked at the tag and he said, "Oh, yeah, I already had a shot of morphine, huh?" And he said, "Well, you've only had one. Here, have another one just for the hell of it. You'll feel better."
Mm-hmm.
So he gave me a second shot of morphine. And that really mellowed me out very nicely.
Mm-hmm.
The first one just, I disassociated myself from my aching on the right side. Choppers were coming in, and the medics were coming over and picking guys to go, and they kept always picking over me and picking somebody hurt worse.
Mm-hmm.
So it was disappointing. It made sense.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I was able to look around and see, and he'd get almost down to me, and then another load of guys would come down, and some hurt a little bit worse.
Mm-hmm.
So the last ship of the night, just as it was getting dark, was coming in. They put guys on it, and I figured, oh, hell, now I got to spend a bloody night out here.
Mm-hmm.
And just then, a medic at the open cargo bay turned around and said something to a medic over near us, and he gave a signal. And apparently what it meant was there's room for one more. And the ship had to get out of there quick.
Right.
And the medic didn't even look down the line. He just turned, saw me, pointed to me, and pointed to the ship.
Okay.
Great. I got myself up. I limped over to the ship. They helped me get onto the chopper. And chopper pulled up, and that was a very nervous time.
Mm-hmm.
But finally cleared the trees and went off in level flight. It was about a 15-minute flight back to Dock Tow in the big aid station there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the sun was going down. I was feeling very mellow, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the sunset was quite attractive. They closed the doors on the chopper because it was a little cool. And we were sitting there and looking at the other guys and the like, and I looked at one, and he gave me thumbs up, which was always like a greeting among GIs, and I gave him thumbs up back.
Any discussion?
Nah, too noisy in helicopters. Unless
okay.
you have a helmet on and the radio, you can't hear discussion.
Okay.
So we landed, and they're taking guys off, and two medics run up with a stretcher, and they say, "Get on a stretcher." And I said, "Well, you know, it's only about 100 feet over there to where the ambulatory people were." I said, "I can hobble." I said, "Nah, yeah, that's what they all say. Get on a stretcher." So I get on a stretcher, and they ran me over to this line at the end of the line, and they said, "Okay, get off." So I got, and I had to stand in line. And they went off, and it's one of those, what was that all about things?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm waiting in line, and got into the tent fairly quickly. They had probably a couple of surgical teams there from the hospital in Pleiku, and they must have had, 16 tables in two rows set up, and doctors and nurses on each one just going like hell, and then clearing them off and bringing the next guy on. So I got on, I'm laying on my back, and the doctor looks at it, okay, a big chunk of shrapnel. He gives me lidocaine, I believe it was, shots all the way around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he starts cutting, and I can remember hearing the scalpel cutting through the muscle, and not feeling it, but just hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he put that down, which I assume was forceps, and I could feel a tugging on my back, but no pain, and then suddenly a release. And they had one of those stainless steel kidney bowls laying just off, maybe about 7 inches off to the right side of my head, and I hear this thing go clang, cling, cling inside the kidney bowl, you know. And I looked over it, and this thing was huge. I was surprised at how big it was. It was about 3 inches long, 2 inches wide, slightly curved. You could see the machining marks on it, and you could see some Chinese lettering. It had been made in China.
Wow.
And hanging off the jagged edges were pieces of me. So they look at the wound, and they're doing something, and the male nurse, he picks up a piece of shrapnel with pieces of me hanging off of it, and said, "You want to keep this for a souvenir?" And I said, "Oh, hell yes." So they wrapped it up in gauze, and he put tape around it, and he gave it to me. They got me off the table. Gave me some antibiotics and the like, and then I was transferred to a Chinook, a large tandem rotor, medium lift helicopter, filled with stretchers and tiers. And so I got onto one of the stretchers, I think it's several level up on one tier, and they flew us down to the Pleiku Hospital. We went in there and had some more work done, checked over and the like. And I remember by the time they were finished with me, I was one of the last ones that night, because it had gotten dark, there were no more wounded coming in. And they took me into a ward, a nurse did. And again, I was able to walk, kind of funny.
Right.
But I was able to walk. And she took me over to a bed, and she said, "Would you like something to eat?" And I suddenly realized I hadn't eaten all day since that morning.
Oh.
And I suddenly realized I was famished, and I said, "Yeah." said, okay, I'll be right back. And she goes, she comes back a couple minutes later, and she had a ham sandwich, and I swear the ham was 3/4 inch thick on this sandwich. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. And a glass of milk. And it was a fantastic ham sandwich. Everybody else was asleep. It was mm-hmm. it was half dark in the ward.
Mm-hmm.
It was all quiet. And I wolfed down the ham sandwich, and she gave me a pill, which I think was a sleeping pill or some sort of relaxant.
Mm-hmm.
I drank the milk, and she literally tucked me in
mm-hmm.
and lowered the mosquito nets. You know, you had to
mm-hmm.
close every night. Fell asleep very quickly. Woke up the next morning, and everybody else, they go around waking people up, and
mm-hmm.
everybody was up, and I'm looking around, and I recognize a couple of guys from my platoon, a couple of guys from other companies in the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking to the guy in the bed next to me. And I'm saying, wow, do you remember this and do you remember that yesterday? And I said, wow, do you remember when that guy got hit during that first large mortar barrage, that horrible scream?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, I remember it real clear.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he pointed not directly across the ward, directly across and up, maybe two beds,
mm-hmm.
and he said, there's the guy right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked over, and he had a bandage, a little Band-Aid, across the bridge of his nose.
Okay.
That was it.
What had happened to him?
He caught a little piece of shrapnel in his nose.
Oh, boy.
And he panicked.
Oh, boy.
So I said, you're kidding. And he said, no. He said, he said, I could have swore that guy had his legs blown off or something. And I said, you're kidding. That little wound on it wasn't on the very top of the nose. It was just a little bit off one side.
Uh-huh.
I said, I'll be damned. The nurse asked me, she said, do you think you can walk to the mess hall? She said, it'd be good for you to do a little bit of movement so your muscles don't start seizing up on you from when you impacted the tree.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you know, okay, I'll try. So she was on my left side, and, you know, I'm limping over. We got over there. She got a tray.
Were you still in your uniform?
Oh, no, I was in pajamas.
Okay.
Got a tray, and she put some things on it, and we're walking over to a table, and I look over in a corner, and on the three tables in one corner, it's like, there's the rest of my platoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Various leg wounds, arm wounds, head wounds, you know, not critical, ambulatory, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, wouldn't have been able to fight any longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the nurse, and we went over, and they all looked up, and they all said, Roy, you're dead. I said, what? And he said, somebody said they saw your body.
Huh.
And I said, you're kidding. I said, no, well, I heard you were dead. Said, well, now here I am,
mm-hmm.
you know. So the nurse sat me down with them, and she asked one guy that didn't have a real serious wound, you know, I said, you want to help get back to his barracks if he needs it,
mm-hmm.
Or back to the ward? And he said, yeah, we'll take care of him, you know, and then she went off.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked and the like, and then somebody said, gee, boy, your parents are going to be really upset when they get that Red Cross notice. And I said, what Red Cross notice?
Oh, no.
And they said, well, you were reported missing in action because they couldn't confirm the body, but somebody said they'd seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I thought of my mother, and I'm going, oh, God.
Mm-hmm.
So I hurried up and ate, and I said, I got to find a place to send a message. They got me back to the ward. I told one of the nurses about it, and she said, okay, wait a minute. And a few minutes later, she came in with a wheelchair, and she took me over to the Red Cross section.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, I was listed as missing in action.
Hmm.
But it hadn't gone out yet.
Okay.
I mean, there were hundreds of guys killed and wounded. So I told them, stop that. I'm right here. Here's my dog tags and everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm right here. I'm wounded, but not missing in action. And he said, okay, do you want me to change that to just, you're wounded then, or do you want me to not say anything at all? I said, nah, tell him I'm wounded, but I'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all right, we'll take care of it. So I headed that, because my mother would have gone absolutely nuts.
Okay.
And then I wrote a letter, got back, and I wanted to write a letter but I couldn't use my right arm. So a nurse wrote a letter, and I described what had happened, the wound and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that letter beat the Red Cross notice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and my sister had, checked the mailbox. My mother was at work. My stepfather was at Fort Devens,
mm-hmm.
and he was working. And she read it, and she called him. And so he got permission to leave to go tell my mother.
Mm-hmm.
My mother, until the day she died, and it was backed up by my sister and stepfather,
mm-hmm.
had always insisted that when I was hit mm-hmm. on that date, 21st November,
mm-hmm.
she knew exactly when something had happened to me.
Really?
And I've heard this before from other mothers.
Mm-hmm.
And my stepfather and my sisters say, yeah, Mom was suddenly a wreck and said, something's happened to Andy. I'd been wounded once before, very lightly. But,
mm-hmm.
but of course, on the news, the Battle of Hill 875 was like on the news constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew my unit was there.
Mm-hmm.
But they said, yeah, just about that time, the equivalent on the 21st was when she said, something's happened to Andy. I never really did believe it
mm-hmm.
until I read, you know, even though my stepfather and my sisters backed it up, I just found it, I don't believe in psychic things.
Right.
But I've read a couple of other accounts,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know. So, why don't we break off here?
Okay. This is Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Antoine Roy. It's April 7th, 2003. At about 8:45 a.m. Central Standard Time. Sir, let's start with where we left off. You were in the hospital. You described that experience, and this is in November 1967, and you were discharged. Did you go back to your unit from there, or did you go to, were you assigned to a new unit?
No, I went back to my battalion in the rear
mm-hmm.
where I was on light duty for about a week. For the final healing to take place
mm-hmm.
and to do some physical therapy to, you know, get the back ready for carrying that massive rucksack.
How limited were you from your wound?
Actually, I was feeling pretty good when I got back. I had a big bandage on the back, but there wasn't a lot of pain, and the exercises didn't cause a lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So I just performed minor details and exercise, and you know, everything was fine. The medic took a final look at it,
mm-hmm.
bandage, and they shipped me back out to the field. Now I was in the rear area at that time for the battalion was in the Army base section of Tuiwa on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
My unit at that time, at least C Company of the 4th Battalion, was a little bit to the northwest of there at a place called Dung Tre.
Mm-hmm.
It had been the scene of a lot of fighting earlier. And it was a special forces camp.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been another threat to it. So the unit was sent up there. I got back up there. I joined the unit. In fact, I even have a couple of pictures of, you know, that first day back in the
mm-hmm.
big mountain that was kind of overlooking the Special Forces camp.
How did the guys welcome you back?
A lot of them were surprised. They never expected to see me again.
They thought you were going to die?
Or no.
They just thought you'd be transferred.
A lot of the serious wounded were sent to, if it wasn't too bad, they kept you in country. If it was worse, they'd send you to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
If it was even worse, you went back to the States. Well, I was scheduled to go back to the States,
mm-hmm.
and I was going to be put into Fort Devens Army Hospital, which is where my stepfather was stationed at the time.
Hmm.
So I'd have been, you know, my mother and sisters and everything. I would have been there. But then the big battles that, looking back now on things, were lead-ups to TAT,
mm-hmm.
The battles with 1st Cav Division at Bong Son, the battles down at the Sung Bay, and I forget the other special forces camp in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Uprang was one. And Doc Toe had also been another one.
Mm-hmm.
These big battles were to try and draw American troops way out into the mountains. And the North Vietnamese had figured that these battles would go on for a long enough time for them to kick off the offensive. Well, we reacted so strongly that the enemy was defeated fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But still, after a battle, you stay in the area and you look around, you try and find their supply caches and make sure they're gone. You try and trail them for a while, whatever. Anyway, I was sent back to the unit there at the Dong Tray, and everybody was glad to see me. And I'd been there about 3 hours when suddenly I didn't quite feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I know, my hands were shaking. I was nauseous. I was running a fever. And the medic took one look at me and said, "You're out of here." So I was evacuated. Now, I don't know if I've told you about malaria.
Yes, you did.
Right. You
yes,
have you to have the blood test during the attack.
Mm-hmm.
Or the parasite has already... What causes the attack is a parasite bursting out of the red blood cells,
mm-hmm.
and that causes a toxicity in the blood. Then all the parasites go looking for another host. They find another red blood cell, and boom, they go inside.
Mm-hmm.
So after the attack is over, the parasite is hidden again.
Right.
So by the time they got me back again, you know, it was the same thing. Since they couldn't find the parasite, they had to call it fever of unidentified origin, which the doctors knew what it was,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, without a firm diagnosis, that's all they can say.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at that time, I think, like I told you, we were all taking medications. So when you had an attack, a lot of time it was slapped down kind of quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have this temporary little attack that might last 2 or 3 hours, and then you won't have another one for a long time.
Do you think you had that attack because your immune system was weakened after, you know, your wounding and hospital stay?
Gee, I really couldn't tell you.
Okay.
I just thought it was kind of ironic. Gee, I just got out here and now I'm
right
back again.
Right.
So they kept me in arrear for 5 days. During that time, my company had pulled out of the special forces camp that they were helping to guard and were sent into the mountains around the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I joined them on the next resupply. I hadn't really gotten to know all the new guys
mm-hmm.
in the unit because the unit had been decimated so terribly at Doc Toe. I look at this thing going on in Iraq now,
mm-hmm.
and they haven't taken the amount of casualties that we took on just the Battle of Hill 875 alone yet.
Right.
Anyway...
Let me ask you a question real quick. When you're back in the rear like that for 5 days, and, you know, after we know who you are now and how you have formed relationships with the guys in your unit,
mm-hmm.
and do you miss the guys? Do you think about where they are?
Is there
a guilt associated with not being with them?
It's your family. Well, yeah, there's a guilt. It's kind of a two-edged feeling. There's a guilt, but at the same time, there can be kind of a relief that
mm-hmm.
you're not humping that rucksack, that you know, you're not doing all the heavy work, that you're out of the danger and the like.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of, for me anyway, personally, of asking for a rear echelon job, with two Purple Hearts already and the like, I probably could have asked for and maybe received. Three Purple Hearts, you could get a rear echelon job
mm-hmm.
easily. But it was just out of the question. I mean, I was a combat soldier. So even though I didn't do everything possible to get out there as soon as I could, you know,
mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to go back out, and I knew it was only going to be so long.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Also, life in the rear can be, in the hospital, life was great, but life in the rear can be a little bit difficult because there's a lot more officers and NCOs around, and they want all this Mickey Mouse stuff, like your boots shined and your gig line straight, and then you got details you have to perform, and you know you got to kind of put up with that.
Mm-hmm.
You develop relationships with guys in the rear too, especially those supporting your company, your battalion. But your real family, they're an extended family. Your real family is your platoon and your company.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I guess it was, I don't know, 2-3 days, 4 days, 5 days, whatever it was later when it was time for resupply. I went back out again, arrived, and again, much to everybody's surprise, because they thought, well, you know, must be malaria and they'll probably send them to Japan, but I recovered quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I got into the squad and I got to meet all these new guys that had taken over as replacements. The day I got there, the day before, in fact, one new guy had been killed by a booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was gone, the platoon had received a new platoon leader because ours had been killed on Hill 875. But he killed himself with a booby trap.
Mm-hmm.
In both cases, it was a matter of somebody being new.
Mm-hmm.
And not understanding things yet.
Right.
The first person who was pulling point for the first time on a patrol tripped a booby trap. And instead of falling straight to the ground, he just kind of stood there for a second. So he caught some shrapnel.
Mm-hmm.
And then he panicked, which is the next thing you don't do. And he turned around and he ran almost a kilometer back to the company, ran up to the company commander and said, "I'm wounded," and dropped dead because the shrapnel was in his heart.
Mm.
How he ran a kilometer, nobody knows.
Why would you put an FNG at point?
Well, they got to learn sooner or later.
Yeah, okay.
I was only, it was probably my second, maybe third day in the field that I was put on plane.
Right.
But you have a very experienced person right behind you.
Mm-hmm.
The point man has a support person right behind him, and he's known as the slack man. So while the point man's looking straight ahead, and usually they'll come to an agreement, and maybe to the right or the left,
mm-hmm.
the guy behind him will be looking over his shoulder ahead and also glancing in the opposite direction.
Right.
So you have a point man and a slack man. The slack man was a guy named Kowalski, who was extremely experienced. In fact, pulled point a hell of a lot of times themselves. But the man panicked. The man didn't drop down immediately. Kowalski heard it was a very simple booby trap. It was just a grenade with a wire going across trail. I mean, we used to see them all the time. It's a wonder anybody ever thought that you wouldn't see them. But anyway. So Kowalski yelled booby trap and hit the ground, and the cherry, or the new guy,
mm-hmm.
Turned around and said, "What?" And then the grenade went off.
Mm.
The platoon leader, they were on a patrol, and in an open area, you spread further apart.
Right.
And as it gets more forested, you get closer and closer together. Well, they'd been in a forested area that came out into a wide open area. They were following a trail. And anything on a trail that just doesn't look right, everybody just subconsciously, you'll learn this,
mm-hmm.
steps around it. If it's extremely suspicious, somebody puts a piece of toilet paper on it, white.
Mm-hmm.
It stands out, of course, in nature. But what was on the trail was like a gourd, you know, like a melon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just sitting there on the trail. Well, you know, most of the guys, experienced guys, I mean, like myself, come along. We'd notice it, but we'd just step around it. There was no reason to suspect anything else. Well, the platoon leader came along, and he saw the gourd. Now, the platoon leader has to have his radio telephone, his radio operator, pretty close to him so that he can get to the radio quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when the platoon leader come along, he saw the gourd. He had this tremendous urge to kick it. And he did. And just as he went to kick it, his radio operator realized what he was going to do and screamed out, "No!" And the kick went through, and it was a booby-trapped American 105-millimeter artillery round.
Jeez.
Now, it killed the officer immediately.
Mm-hmm.
The radio operator, having to have been closer to the officer because he's carrying the radio, he died of his wounds.
Okay.
Both of those cases were things where, you know, the person hadn't learned yet, or it hadn't become habit and subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
So let me
ask you a quick question. How did you personally, and then how did your platoon deal with the new guys when they would come in field?
You know, I keep hearing, I don't know how many times I've heard and read, new guys come in, nobody wants to get to know them because they might die.
Yeah, that's like the stereotype.
That's a bunch of bullshit. That is absolute bullshit.
Uh-huh.
You have to depend upon each other. I mean, I've been in three different units.
Right.
I've been with so many guys. You have to depend on each other. And the first thing you do when somebody new comes in, usually the first question asked,
mm-hmm.
What state are you from?
Right.
Okay? And, you know, your name, your rank, and they can pretty well tell, you know, if it's your first tour or not.
Mm-hmm.
They might ask where you went training at, stuff like that. A lot of units would assign the person to a mentor for a few days. In the 173rd and 101st, we didn't do that. I think we should have.
Mm-hmm.
But generally everybody looked, and everybody was more than willing to offer advice.
Okay.
I mean, just so more than willing. And one thing we would always do is, you remember hearing, and the guy would say, "Yeah, I heard that all the time," and we'd tell him, "Forget it. That's one of those rumors that don't happen. Don't worry about little kids coming up and offering you a soda to sell.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not going to have ground glass in it, and no, it's not going to be an explosive. These people love their children just like everybody else, and they're not going to blow their little kids up just
mm-hmm.
to get an American."
Mm-hmm.
You know, things like that. And then the person, like I said, they wouldn't be put in point, but they'd be put with experienced people, and everybody offered this person advice for two reasons. The first one was survival of the group.
Right.
He makes a wrong mistake, he can not only get himself killed, but somebody else killed too. Secondly, he's one of you now, he's one of the family, and we look out for each other. So all this stuff, I hear this, and I hear this, I heard a lot of things, and to me, some people write it in the books because it sounds like the vogue thing to say. It's like, you know, you view a body, and it's all mangled,
mm-hmm.
and the guy will say, "Oh, I turned around and vomited." I have never, ever, ever seen that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I have never had that happen to me, and I've had to lift up some really gross kind of bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Never felt nausea. Maybe that emotional revulsion that makes you emotionally pull back. You know, or it's one of the myths.
Why so many stereotypes? Why so many myths about that?
I think the press helped perpetuate it. It's a great emotional kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
and the press just loves emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing I can think of is that maybe it did happen once in a while, or somebody was telling a war story, and the press picked it up, and from then on, you know,
mm-hmm.
I read books from soldiers in other wars, and actually I hear some similar things there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand it. I haven't seen it. I haven't talked to anybody. Like I said, I've been in three different units,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, and there are several of those. There's a lot of those myths, in fact.
Right, I know.
An awful lot of those myths.
Do you remember the scene in Platoon when Charlie Sheen arrives with the guy and they immediately go out on patrol? and he's really treated almost opposite of what you just described, kind of this outcast, this idiot who doesn't know how to pack his pack, doesn't know how to do anything, and suffers from it.
You don't do that. If it's something really innocuous, ain't going to hurt anybody. Well, like me on my first time. I pulled out the machete, and here I am just chopping away like hell through
right.
this thing. And gotten about 50, 60 yards or so, and I just can't go any further. And took around and looked around behind me, and here's all those guys standing there just waiting for me and with big smiles on their faces, saying, you know that thing about you got to cut your way through the jungle? Says, as you can see, you know, you don't want to do that because, number one, you're going to be exhausted. Number two, the enemy will hear you coming for a kilometer away. But that little thing there, they considered a joke.
Right.
But that movie Platoon, that was a Hollywood thing.
Okay.
Especially where I guess it's Martin Sheen was killed at the end.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was right out of Shakespeare. He's on his knees, his hands in the air, and his bullets are hitting him, and he's down, 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 down.
Are you talking about the William Dafoe character?
Oh, maybe it was William Dafoe, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm going, Jesus, I never seen anybody get... I mean, people get shot, and they fall over most of the time, especially when you get shot that way. And then symbolically, his hands in the air, and you know, I'm just going, ugh. There is only one movie I have ever seen that I would say came a little close to reality. And I know that Second World War vets, I've talked to them, they hate watching movies on the Second World War.
Yeah.
Because Hollywood can't get it right, and they got to put this certain drama in it, and you know. Also, that unit had so much dissension between everybody in it.
Right. The one in platoon, you mean.
Right.
Yeah.
It would not be an effective unit at all.
Yeah.
There was never that much dissension in any unit that I was in. Occasionally, two people would have an argument. And I think only three times in the time in the three tours I was there did I see a fist fight. And they were generally broken up immediately.
Which movie? You said you didn't mention the name, but you said it was relatively accurate.
Oh, I'm sorry, Hamburger Hill.
Okay.
They used, you know, wrong kind of helicopters when they accidentally strafed the guys and like. But the uniforms are relatively accurate. Platoon, they're overly dramatic. You, most units, you had to maintain some sort of standard uniform. But, you know, I've always looked at that, and there's another one. The real book is great, but the Hollywood took it and kind of screwed it up, and it's called Platoon Leader. It's about a platoon leader in the 173rd Airborne after I left, and they were supposed to be guarding a village area. And they come across, they're going along, and they come across the waterfall, and they look down, and there's a bunch of North Vietnamese down there taking a bath, and they all silently pull out grenades, and they all throw their grenades, and boom, 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 boom. And they all look down, and then and then they all walk off. Well, that's absurd. Number one, you go down there, and you collect all the weapons. Number two, you make sure that they're all dead, because if the ones that aren't dead, you take them prisoner for intelligence purposes. And you also look for information on their bodies. You count how many bodies. You try and find out what unit they're from, stuff like that, you know. You don't just walk off. I mean, that's ridiculous. And the real book, though, the actual book is excellent. Tragic at the end with the communists harming the people, the end of the civilians like they did. But a very, very good book.
What about Vietnam movies? What are the ones... What are your thoughts on it, in general?
That Hollywood doesn't know how to portray reality, that there is necessarily has to be, certain things that are common to all movies. There has to be some antagonism. They have to maintain stereotypes. There was one movie, Full Metal Jacket, that it was, you know, it was a surrealistic movie. What, it was Stanley Kubrick, and he's good for surrealistic movies. Since it was meant to be surrealistic, that movie didn't bother me at all. I found that interesting, but it was supposed to be surrealistic.
Right.
It wasn't meant to be, you know. The other thing that bothers me about most Vietnam movies is there's always an atrocity shown. It's like, well, Vietnam. If you don't show somebody killing civilians, then it can't be Vietnam. And I really, really, really am resentful towards that.
Right.
Because it's like, that's the defining thing, and thank you, Lieutenant William Calley. Thanks
right.
a lot. And the reporters.
Right. Right. Do you avoid the movies, or do you actually go see them?
I avoid them if at all possible. I think the last one I saw on TV was Firebase Gloria. It's just so stupid.
Have you heard about We Were Soldiers?
Yeah, I know the situation really well. But no, I wasn't about to watch the movie. I had already heard some other veterans talking about it. You know, I just can't picture Mel Gibson in the thing. And
right.
No, I'm not attracted to it at all.
So you do avoid the movies?
I do avoid, yeah.
Okay. Why is that?
Because I'll just sit there and emotionally, intellectually pick it apart. That ain't the way it was, you know.
Is it easier for you to watch other movies from other wars, World War II, say
yeah, it is, actually. But at the same time, having been in war, and also having been an Army brat and always familiar with the military and the like, I know which things aren't real. I mean, the World War II movies will show these German tanks moving. Well, I know for a fact that those are M41 Walker Bulldog tanks. There are tanks. They didn't have any German tanks to use in the movie. You know, like a Panther tank or a Tiger tank or anything. So they're using American tanks. I can also tell usually any kind of explosive is accompanied by a big flash of fire. Well, that's bullshit, too, because most explosions, unless there's something incendiary involved, you're not going to have fire. If you hit a can of gasoline, you will.
Right.
But an explosive is a flash and then smoke. But if you notice, I mean, everything has to have fire in it. And I could never get, why does it have to have fire? Well, it's for dramatic effect.
Right.
The other time, sometimes grenades seem to have the power of artillery rounds. Grenades had power, but they weren't quite as powerful as they tend to show them on the movies. And again, lots of fire coming out, like it's a napalm grenade or something, which they don't make. So, you know, I mean, all war movies, I also know military history. I'm a student of general military history. And, you know, I know a lot. If there's a little bit, you know, I can explain it off. But when it just gets too obvious, then I don't want to hear about it.
What about Saving Private Ryan? That's been hailed as kind of, you know, the most realistic war movie ever made. What are your thoughts on that?
That was close. It was a different war, but at the same time, well, number one, it was too small of a group that went. They'd never send a group that small. But other than that, it wasn't too bad. It was an interesting concept, I felt. There were, you know, those things with some fire and the like. I think I got more into the concept of they're looking for Private, who was it, Private Ryan?
Ryan.
Yeah. And that one wasn't too bad. I don't, you know, that didn't turn me off. I found it a little
okay.
good.
Okay. Interesting.
Vietnam, I get very resentful when there's always some sort of, that movie with Michael Fox was on the other night. It just pisses me off. It's like, that's the defining thing about Vietnam.
Right.
And God damn it, that was not, well, we've been through this.
Right. I've heard that from other veterans as well.
Yes, and I'm very resentful to the American people for that, and for the way they betrayed the South Vietnamese and made, you know, not only betrayed the South Vietnamese, but made everything that we did for 7 years totally in vain. The current war, I don't think had to happen. I'm very impressed. I don't know if it's we're just super good and the Iraqis are super bad. It's probably a matter of both. And we're one thing I do like is that, you know, we're concentrating very heavily on literally winning hearts and minds. I do believe that in Vietnam, and it's not so much atrocities, it's the way that sometimes you act around the people. I always, you know, went by an elderly person, and if it was a man, you know, you do this thing where you put your two hands together like you're praying, and three times you touch your forehead and you bow a little bit to sign of respect. And I'd say, Chabak, which means, hello, old man. And they'd always be very impressed. And in that society, the elderly are highly respected. And if it was an old woman, I'd say, Chaon. We should have gotten an awful lot of more training on the culture and on you better not piss these people off, because they'll be getting back to you on it.
Why do you think that did not happen?
I think they were throwing people too quickly into it. It was a pretty rapid buildup, you know.
Yes.
A lot of people were aware of this, but I think they would just, we got to get these guys trained for combat. The training was pretty good, but I think there should have been a very heavy explanation, accent on these people, their culture, some of their language, and why you will treat them good. You go out of your way, and sergeants and officers and squad leaders should have been very disciplinarian. And I'm not talking about a, you know, killing somebody or something like that. It was just, you know, sometimes we'd set up in a in an abandoned temple, and the temple would be used to store things from another temple. When you stop and think about it, that's like a bunch of foreign soldiers, kids coming and setting up in a church you're not using at a time in this country.
Right.
Now, I can remember at the time, well, it's not being used. It didn't bother me until after I got back, you know, and I started realizing, gee, you know, that could have been kind of offensive, you know. But we were concerned about a defensive position.
Right.
And it was a defensive position. But still, the officers and the NCOs should have been very heavily, you know, taught, find yourself another defensive position. Don't go using, you know, a temple or a church.
Right.
Things like that. Generally, the Vietnamese seem to, the 50% that very actively supported us and the 25% that really didn't care which side went as long as the whole thing ended, they kind of, well, I guess you got to take some shit with the sugar kind of thing.
Right.
You know? And some guys would kind of swagger and just not show any respect. Now, those are guys, I only spent one time when we were around villagers. Generally, you know, I was out in the mountains, and there were no villages out there, except maybe some Montagnard villages up by Duck Toe. But, you know, a lot of respect should have been put into American soldiers, and punishment should have been very severe. Ideally, Lieutenant William Calley would have been tried in Vietnam. He was guilty, and he would have been shot in Vietnam with relatives of the people killed in witness.
Right.
Ideally, that's what would have happened. Unfortunately, it didn't happen.
Right. He's a free man today.
Yeah, last I heard, years ago, he was working in his father-in-law's hardware store. I have no idea where he is now.
I heard he was in Georgia, changed his name, and was working in just private business.
Yeah.
Leading a very low-key life.
It's apparent that Medina knew something, the company commander knew something was going on, too. But he wasn't tried. They went mainly after Callie, and
right.
he got off scot-free, basically.
So. Do you think that one of the lessons from Vietnam for the United States was an emphasis more on hearts and minds and how to interact culturally with the people to try to cross that cultural gap?
Yes. No doubt about it.
Okay.
No doubt about it. That's one good thing that did come out of Vietnam. But even in Vietnam, we really tried not to kill the civilians if they were in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
We really did try. An awful lot of Americans were fascinated with the Vietnamese and tried to talk with them, and you know, a little trade and barter and the like. And the
mm-hmm.
little kids were little kids. I mean, you know, yeah, we were young GIs, but still, GIs and little kids, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There were those few individuals that walked around a little arrogantly that are pushy bullies in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there were some over there. So, you know, but,
yeah.
And those individuals cost us some support from some Vietnamese. But I'm very, very pleased with the way we're doing things in Iraq in that aspect.
Right.
Very pleased.
Did you ever have to personally kind of pull someone back in line and say, look, don't do that. Don't treat them like that.
I would try and explain some things because I had also lived in different countries,
right?
You know, before. If anything was serious, well, I'm thinking of one time we had this Indian, and Indians and alcohol don't get along,
right?
And he'd gotten hold of a few beers, and it was a pimp came out with one of his girls. This is in the village of Fulock on the coast along Highway 1. And this is up north. And Chief had 3 or 4 beers. We called him Chief.
Mm-hmm.
I'll leave his real name out of it. And he was feeling aggressive. And he really kind of pushed this kind of fight on this young Vietnamese man who was pimping his girlfriend or whatever. And then suddenly punched him heavily right in the stomach. Just right below the belt, barely,
mm-hmm.
you know. It was a sucker punch, and it was... And there were 3 or 4 of us standing around. And, you know, we said, hey, come on, Chief, calm down. We also know that Chief, when he had some alcohol in him, none of us wanted to fuck with him too much, you know?
Right.
Because he could turn on you, too.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he was in the Army because he'd stabbed a guy in a barroom brawl,
mm-hmm.
and it was 3 years in jail or 3 years in... 5 years in jail or 3 years in the Army.
Wow.
Basically, he wasn't a bad guy, but he got some alcohol in him, and he's a different person.
Right.
It did not go over positively with the 3 or 4 of us there, and, you know, our attitude was, come on, Chief, leave him alone, will you? And I'm trying to remember if somebody went and got the medic. It wasn't too far from where we had set up. The girl was all upset. I want to say the medic came over, but I really... too vague for me to say whether he did or not.
Mm-hmm.
In the end, his girlfriend helped him limp off. But I'm quite sure that, you know, we didn't make any friends there.
Right, right.
So.
Well, let's go back to when you got back in the field.
Yeah.
After your malaria attack.
I got back to the field. I got to meeting all these new guys and the like. And got right back into the routine
mm-hmm.
pretty quickly.
How did it feel?
Same old, same old.
Okay.
We were just making sporadic contact here, sporadic contact there. And we were in the mountains behind the Rice Bowl area of Tuy Hoa, which was, the Rice Bowl was a large area that went way inland. Into the mountains, it was flat, and the mountains went up around it. Now, a tremendous battle had been fought in that Rice Bowl area up against the mountains 2 years previously by the 101st Airborne Division,
mm-hmm.
and it was one heck of a battle. There were a lot of civilians killed because they were wives, the families of the combination North Vietnamese Regiment and local Viet Cong, and they refused to leave. And we operated in that area, and you couldn't even tell there had been a tremendous group of villages there. It was just so flat. There was, you could tell something had been there, you know. But we're in the mountains operating behind there, and all of a sudden we got the word, you're to come down out of the mountains and find a flat area large enough, wide enough, and secure enough for medium-lift helicopters, Chinook CH-47s, to pick your company up and be prepared to go into immediate combat. You had to get down into this position now. Mm-hmm. Turn around, get down there. What the heck? We didn't know. We turned around. We got down into this flat area just down below the mountains, down in the Rice Bowl area. And we set up in some dry, abandoned rice paddies. And that night, I was taking my turn at guard. And we were about 25 miles, maybe, from Tuy Wah City and the air base and the like on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't notice anything too much out of the ordinary. I noticed flares. Not too uncommon. Maybe there were a few extra more flares than normal, but I didn't pick up on anything unusual. The night went through. It was a quiet night. And the next day the orders were to stay where you are, be prepared to be redeployed at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we stayed where we were, and we just conducted patrolling, you know, all around to make sure nobody could sneak up on us. And then the word came in that Tuy Wah Air Force Base, the American Air Force Base, had been attacked, and that we were going to go in and sweep up what was left of the attackers, that the Air Force security had pretty well held them off, but they were still in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea of going to the Air Force Base for us was fantastic, because we knew we could sweep the area real quick.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably partake of what the Air Force had to offer at their bases. They had snack bars with hamburgers and theaters. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
So the Chinooks come in, helicopter gunships flying around, air cover. And it picked us up, and we're all feeling kind of good. You know, we'll go in, sweep the area, and wow, we'll probably stay at the Air Force base tonight. Well, we fly and we fly, and we come in for a landing, and I look out through one of the porthole-type windows, and what is this? This isn't the Air Force Base. The side I was on, I could look over to my left and see the city of Tuy Wah.
Mm-hmm.
I look over on the right, and I could see what looked like a stone castle, and then barbed wire and some American artillerymen. So the and we ended up landing on this little small airstrip. Well, we got out, the Chinooks took off, and we're standing there, and I look over, and there's this perimeter in front of this stone castle. It turned out to be a prisoner of war camp,
mm-hmm.
and it was manned by a battalion, a battery of American artillerymen, and they had bunkers securing their perimeter. And there were dead North Vietnamese just hanging in the wire. I've got a photograph of one bunker. There's a stack of bodies 4 feet high and, you know, 8 feet, 9 feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys were giving us thumbs up. On the other side of the airfield, there must be 2,000-3,000 civilians all packed up and just, you know, Googling at us.
Mm-hmm.
And what the hell's going on? We hear some firing and the like up to the front. Well, then we get the word. Well, no, this isn't Tuy Wah Air Force Base. This is an airstrip in Tuy Wah. The city was attacked last night, about 1 o'clock, by the 95th North Vietnamese Regiment, which was the predominant North Vietnamese regiment in the Tuy Wah area. And the South Vietnamese had been fighting since about 1 a.m. and had managed to push the North Vietnamese all the way out of the city and had them now surrounded in a very out right on the edge of the city limits in this little village. And the South Vietnamese were exhausted. And this was about 11 o'clock in the morning. So they had been fighting, 10 hours or so. So we were going to take over now that the enemy was pinned in. And then another one of our sister companies came in, B Company. So we got started. We headed the end of the airstrip, and then you had to cross this road that looked down towards the village where the NVA were, and right across the road there were some houses and the like. And as I got up there, I noticed that, you know, guys found out real quick you had to run across the road fast because bullets would come flying down that road from the village at them. So the firing stopped. I started to run out, and all of a sudden a machine gun opened up. And I'm it right in front of me, and I drop flat. And the bullets are going over my head. The guy following me, he was flat on the back edge of the road. And I remember looking down there, trying to, you know, make myself part of the road, and then looking over, and here's all these Vietnamese. And it's like we were putting on a show for them. But every once in a while, one Vietnamese would fall back suddenly and get, because he's being hit by North Vietnamese fire. And it's like people would look at him, and maybe a friend or something would pick him up, carry him off. But I'm wondering, what the hell's the matter with those people? Standing there in the line of fire. So the firing lit up for a second. I jumped up real quick, got across the road and up against the side wall of some huts heading towards that village. And as we were going in, the South Vietnamese were coming out carrying their dead and wounded with them. And they were all smiles. And they were all thumbs up, you know, because they had literally kicked the devil out of that regiment. And what was left out of 1,800 men was approximately maybe 350.
Wow.
Trapped in that little village with a prisoner of war camp on to the north side. The B Company that came in, they occupied a village to the east of it, so they couldn't get out. We occupied a large sand hill overlooking it to the south, and to the west was nothing but green flat rice paddies for about a fifth of a mile where there was a tree line. And in that tree line were two companies of South Korean infantry. And if they tried to go across those flat rice paddies, they'd have been slaughtered because we also had helicopter gunships flying overhead. So the South, as we're moving up the side of the road up against the buildings, the South Vietnamese are coming out. But not all the South Vietnamese leave. Some of them refused. They had fought during that battle, and they were determined to see it right through to the end. So I remember we got along, and we started up this sand hill, and I saw a friend of mine, a guy I just made contact with about a month ago, a guy named Atkins. Suddenly, boom, his head went back a bit, and he dropped, and a bullet had hit top of his helmet, went straight through, cut a groove in the helmet liner, which was inside the helmet, and gone straight on back. And I had a photograph of him standing there the next day holding both, and you could see the hole in the helmet and the groove along his helmet. I sent the picture to him. He still has the helmet to this day.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, God, Atkins. And I went running up further, and then there was another guy with bright red hair, and I thought it was one of our guys named Kowalski. He'd been hit in the head with a bullet, and so I couldn't tell, you know, who he was exactly.
Was this the same guy who was such a good point man?
Yes.
Okay.
He was a good point man, but he wasn't a nice guy.
Okay.
Back in the States, he belonged in a state penitentiary or an asylum for the criminally insane. He was a gang member from About my height, sure, bright red hair from Newark, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And very brave in battle, but not a nice guy. Anyway, we got up to this sand hill, and somebody had to face, I remember looking down into the village, and you could see the village. It wasn't very big at all, palm trees sticking up and the like. And then they had me move back and cover the rear, just in case there were any more North Vietnamese in this village to the rear. The village to the rear of us on the very edge of the city was on fire.
Mm-hmm.
So every once in a while, though, I'd get up and I'd look over the front. And they had helicopters come over with loudspeakers requesting the North Vietnamese to surrender. And all they received was small arms fire.
Okay.
So then they flew another helicopter over and they dropped tear gas on this village. They determined the wind was going out across the rice paddies, and by the time it got to the South Springs, it would have been dispersed. So, and they let them cook in that for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. And then they came over again in a helicopter with loudspeaker and then told them, you know, you're completely surrounded. It's earlier in the day. Surrender. Well, again, all they got was just a huge volume of small arms fire. So at that point, we just said, well, if that's the way you want it, then that's the way you want it. And so they had airstrikes coming in. And this is the closest I have ever been to an airstrike, dropping 250-pounders and 500-pounders. And a 500-pound bomb is a massive explosion.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know how to explain how big it is. They came in from behind us. They'd line up behind us, and then the village in a straight line would be our hill, the sand hill, and then the village.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come in, and you'd see the bomb drop, and I thought you could swear to God that bomb was coming right for us.
Mm-hmm.
And those things did happen. Well, the bomb came in maybe 25 feet over our heads.
Wow.
Going forward and slammed into the village. Just prior to this, we start digging in because we know, well, you know, bombs coming in and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So we get our entrenching tools and we start digging in the sand and start finding these little clotted things. And then everybody realized all at once, you know, with these villages and the like, they don't have plumbing. This sand hill was the toilet.
Oh, boy.
So to the 4th Battalion of the 503rd Parachute Infantry Regiment,
mm-hmm.
and, of course, we're talking about the Tet Offensive here.
Right.
It was known to us as the Battle of Shit Hill. And you talk to anybody who's there, and they'll always call it the Battle of Shit Hill.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to dig in. And I remember all these dried up little turds and everything, throwing them away. Oh, God.
What? When was this, time-wise?
Well, this was Tet.
Okay, so it was end of January, 1st of February, 68.
Yeah.
Okay.
I forget which days.
Yeah.
I remember the jets coming in. The first bomb came in. And we didn't know it until later on. There were approximately 30 survivors, I believe, all seriously wounded at the end. But we didn't know if that first bomb hit their headquarters group and wiped it out.
Okay.
So there was nobody to even organize a surrender if they'd wanted to. I mean, the head of the beast had been cut off.
Mm-hmm.
And the jets just kept coming in and coming in. And the next time I looked up over the top, there was just nothing there. There was maybe a couple of palm trees broken in half, some low walls, maybe 2 or 3 feet high, and those just kept coming in. The thing is, we couldn't afford to play any games. We didn't know it at the time, but our superiors did, that the attacks were happening all over Vietnam.
Right.
We had to be freed up to head to other emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we couldn't afford this long negotiation kind of thing.
Right.
We had to destroy them and be ready to move.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the attacks, the jet, the air assault, one bomb came in, I remember, and I don't know if you notice bombs from the air when they go off, there's kind of like a shell.
Mm-hmm.
It's, when you're close, it's a bluish white, and it's the shock wave.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just ahead of all the material and smoke that's being blown up. And as it gets to a, it's a hemisphere, and as it gets to a certain point, it starts to break up. And I don't know if you've noticed that, next time when you see explosions from the air.
Mm-hmm.
This one bomb came in, and right on the lip of this expanding hemisphere, which is the shock wave mm-hmm. starting up, is a North Vietnamese soldier. And this is one of those sights that are so vivid, even to this day. He was on his back, flying straight up in the air, or maybe at a slight angle. And I can remember his clothes. It's like they had all been ripped, and they were flapping
mm-hmm.
very, very rapidly as he was going up. And he went up about 150 feet on his back.
Mm.
And then he went over, and boom. If the explosion didn't kill him, the sudden stop at the bottom did.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all paratroops. And all of a sudden, I remember everybody on the hill just raised their hand and went airborne. Like, you know, this was an airborne North Vietnamese soldier.
Right.
gallows humor.
Right, right.
But then the, you know, and then after the jet attack stopped, then mortars and artillery just started hitting them. We just kind of took it easy.
Mm-hmm.
It just kept going and going and going. It went into nightfall. I remember they had armored personnel carriers bringing in hot rations to us even,
mm-hmm.
which was a surprise. All night long, it was flare lit. There was no attempt to get out, no attempt to attack our rear. We just waited till morning.
Mm-hmm.
And in the morning, we all just stood up. And I remember looking down and saying, my God, I mean, it just looked like a freshly plowed field. B Company was starting to make a sweep into the site, and that's
mm-hmm.
they recovered about 30 very seriously wounded. The other rest of the 350, 380, whatever it was then, they were all dead. My company lost 5 killed. B Company lost 10 killed. South Vietnamese, I don't know. South Koreans, I don't believe, lost them. They were too far off.
Mm-hmm.
But South Vietnamese had done pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, a few years ago, and I damned if I can find it again, on the internet I found this account by this little boy
mm-hmm.
who had been 10 years old at the time. And he watched, he witnessed this battle. He was in that crowd of people.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Huh.
Freaked his mother right out because he left the house.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about how hard the South Vietnamese were fighting the North Vietnamese, and then the Americans coming in,
mm-hmm.
and how impressed he was. And I can't find it. I printed it out, and I can't find it again. But I remembered how ironic. My God, here's this 10-year-old little boy that was watching me at age 19,
mm-hmm.
you know, in combat. But anyway, after it was done, they took us back to the Army base at Tuy Hoa. And just to be on alert to go someplace else local, this is where we found out for the first time that the whole country, you know, there had been these attacks countrywide.
Mm-hmm.
But we were on the impression we were on stand down. And I remember going over to the PX, and guys were going swimming, and all of a sudden, the alert went out. Everybody get together. We're headed out.
Mm-hmm.
So runners had to go out and gather everybody. And the intel was that they found
air reconnaissance had discovered either North Vietnamese or Viet Cong retreating from Thuy Hoa City. These must have been some survivors. And we were going to go out and head them off.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us out in Chinooks, and we never found anything. We never found any sign, no trail, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were extremely annoyed. They took us off what we considered stand down.
Right.
And sent us out there on what ended up being a wild goose chase.
Mm-hmm.
We at least expected to find some sign that there was apparently about 100 guys, air reconnaissance had said.
Mm-hmm.
And if they walk someplace, they'll leave some sort of sign that they passed by. And we just didn't find anything, nothing at all.
Hmm.
So they decided to leave us out there, and we just continued operations the way we always had.
Do you remember how you felt when you did hear about the countrywide attacks? What was your impression?
Oh, wow, we knew right away that was stupid.
Hmm.
For them to come out in force against the firepower of the United States, our allies that were there,
mm-hmm.
And we knew the South Vietnamese were starting to come around pretty good. It just didn't make any sense. Wei held out for 2 weeks, but we also knew they were taking tremendous casualties, and that in the end, you know, it wasn't going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
Cholon, I think they held out for, 5 days, something mm-hmm. like that. But again, in the end, the main thing that impressed us was that, number one, the South Vietnamese stood and fought
mm-hmm.
during Tet. That impressed us. Number two, the North Vietnamese had always said, you know, if they started something big, then all the people and everything would turn against us.
Right.
And that was completely the opposite. The people did not turn against us at all,
mm-hmm.
or the government of South Vietnam. And this reinforced in me the feeling that the people were not with the communists.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing that impressed me negatively is that the Viet Cong, although Viet Cong lost just about all their combat troops, after that any Viet Cong combat unit was actually filled out with North Vietnamese. Viet Cong were delegated to intelligence, recruitment,
mm-hmm.
Logistics, some fighters, but generally not.
Mm-hmm.
North Vietnamese completely took over everything, which is just fine. In fact, there was a big debate after the war. A lot of the Viet Cong weren't allowed to take very much part in the government after the war.
Mm-hmm, right.
And their attitude was, this is the way the North Vietnamese had of getting rid of the military arm of the Viet Cong so they could completely and literally take over the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually this was going to be an occupation by North Vietnam, not a reunification of Vietnam, which is exactly what happened if you read some of the Vietnamese accounts.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of Vietnamese, Viet Cong, suspected that this was the reason they did it. Actually, Vo Nguyen Giap actually did seem to think that the country would rise up.
Mm-hmm.
The South Vietnamese army would disintegrate, and he must have been in for a rude shock.
Mm-hmm.
But then found himself in for a very pleasant surprise in the form of one Walter Cronkite, who stood there and said, "We've lost the war."
Right.
Now, why the hell he said that, I have no idea. We just killed tens of thousands of North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. I mean, and a lot of their infrastructure had exposed itself. I have no idea why he made that statement, but he was so respected, a reporter, by so many people, that that was it for us.
Did you feel... Or did you hear that when he did make that announcement, 68?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I had already known the press was negative towards us. That was obvious.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't like reporters, generally. I had heard things that were validated when I went home on my first leave between my first and second tour and saw then the American officials go away, and the reporters say, but as soon as the Americans went away, the South Vietnamese officials took all the tractors, put them in trucks, and drove off with them. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they didn't say was that, yeah, they drove off to a certain location so that they could bring these farmers in and show them how to mechanically maintain them.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't say that. The implication was the South Vietnamese officials stole the tractors from them and sold them,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. You know, it was just... But I tried not to pay too much attention to that. I was fascinated by what was going on in the States, the hippie thing, the psychedelic
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh, boy. And still one foot was in Vietnam.
Right. When did
More
you go home?
More than one foot.
When were you home on leave between tours?
That would have been May, late May, mid-May, mid-June.
Mm-hmm.
68.
Okay.
I had a good time, but I knew I was going back, and more than half of me was still there. I was fascinated. There was a friend that I'd known. His father was stationed at Fort Devens with my stepfather,
mm-hmm.
so there was somebody that I knew, and then there were my cousins and the like. But it was like looking from the outside in. And I was kind of, gee, boy, when I get out, this looks really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I went back over.
How did you, you re-up before you left to go home?
No, I extended my tour.
Okay.
You get to extend your tour for 6 months at a time.
Why did you extend?
Because I didn't want to go back to garrison duty. I believed in the cause.
Mm-hmm.
I felt we were winning.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be a door gunner. I used
oh, yeah.
to love to fly in helicopters
mm-hmm.
when the choppers used to ferry us around.
Right.
And to have a machine gun in front of you all the time, that, you know, you got some power and the like. Yeah, I'd seen choppers go down, but...
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be a gunner.
Okay.
And I had already known that by the time I'd been in country 9 months. But when I was... Well, not even 9 months, maybe a little bit earlier than that, 7 months. When I was in the hospital, I was talking to some guys about it, and they were from the 1st Cav Division. I said, you guys know about any good helicopter units? And they all said, oh, man, the one that supports us all the time, they're fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go anywhere. They'll do anything. And I said, what unit's that? And they said it was the 227th Assault Helicopter Battalion.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept that in mind. And when time came, you know, I decided to extend, that's the unit I asked to go to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you could go to any unit as long as you were qualified or could be trained OJT fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And door gunners, a lot of door gunners, easily over half, were OJT and many times infantrymen who, like myself, because helicopter crews and infantrymen were sort of like brothers. They were our contact to the rear.
Mm-hmm.
They brought us our food, our ammunition, our reinforcements. They took out our wounded, our dead. And when infantrymen, we had a mail sack every 5 days. But a lot of guys, you run up to a door gunner, he'd take your letters and he'd stuff it on the inside of this armored vest that he'd wear.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd mail it when they got back. And it became like a sacred responsibility to them.
Right.
And you know, we looked up to them. They were like brothers. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and they looked to us like that
mm-hmm.
because they would either see the aftermath or take us into the thing or fly overhead and watching us, and they were concerned about us all the time. They,
mm-hmm.
they'd do anything for us.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
before we get started again, let me pause for a second and change out the disc, okay?
Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Well, let me ask you, did anything significant happen between February and May 68 before you went home on leave that you want to talk about?
After Tet,
mm-hmm.
We didn't run into much in the way of heavy units. The North Vietnamese 95th Regiment, plus their Viet Cong reinforcements had been shattered. scattered in the area. And it was mainly search and destroy for what was left.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly they were reinforced by North Vietnamese regulars reinforced in the 95th.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was just generally going through the mountains. We were making slight meeting kind of contacts. Once in a while we run into a fire base. Nothing really terrible that I remember happening. Our platoon, or my platoon, 2nd Platoon, was detached for a little bit more than a week to the integral armor force that was attached to the 173rd.
Mm-hmm.
And they had M48 tanks and M113 armored personnel carriers. Now, I had never operated with armor before, and this looked like this may be really fun.
Mm-hmm.
So we started out from Tuiwa Army Base. We drove up Highway 1 until we reached Tuiwa City, the south end of it, and then we turned off onto Highway 7,
mm-hmm.
or 7A, which headed up into the mountains. Now, this highway was the same highway that at the end of the war,
mm-hmm.
the South Vietnamese Army and all those civilians retreated down,
right.
and were slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is that same road. The whole area had been covered with villages. The road ran alongside of a river, but all those people had been evacuated out and everything destroyed so that the North Vietnamese Viet Cong wouldn't have a source of food and intelligence and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And the people were moved in closer to the city where they could be guarded,
mm-hmm.
Guarded and protected. So we're driving along, and there was, you know, we could see the ruins of buildings here and there.
Mm-hmm.
The river was also a canal now and then. There were some North Vietnamese here and there. We made contact 3 or 4 times, and some sniper fire. But I remember being incredibly impressed with the firepower of armor. And we had a really good time. We really did.
What kind of firepower are you talking about that you were impressed with?
Well, the two tanks with us, of course, had 90mm guns plus mm-hmm. their 50 calibers, and they also had a coaxial 7.62mm machine gun.
Okay.
And the M113s were in the model known of as an ACAV,
mm-hmm.
or an armored cavalry vehicle. It had a 50 caliber machine gun facing forward with a little shield on it
mm-hmm.
for the gunner. And then facing off to each side, they could fire straight to the side, slightly to the rear, to the front, were 2 M60 machine guns
mm-hmm.
with shields on them. And then they normally had one man with a rifle and a grenade launcher facing the rear. Now, we were assigned to them, our platoon, and so we rode on top, except when we had to dismount to check something out, or there was some firepower or whatever, sniper fire or whatever, a little meeting engagement. And most of these engagements with no more than 4 individuals, 5 individuals at a time. Nothing really threatening to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we drove through these areas, and you could see, you know, wow, this used to be a very prosperous area. I remember setting up in the ruins of a house once for the night, and as I was digging my foxhole, I found a little teapot,
mm-hmm.
ceramic teapot, in sort of a Chinese style, blue on white,
mm-hmm.
and I still have it to this day.
Do you really?
Yeah, it was made in China. It looked like an import from China. I don't read Chinese. There was a stamp on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
For all I know, it's a Ming Dynasty worth $1 million, but I doubt it. the spout, the end of the spout was a little broken. It has a little cap on it and 2 little pieces of wire for picking it up
mm-hmm.
To go from one side of the cap to the other. And I still have it.
Hmm.
I'd sent it home with film packed inside of it. Carried it around with it for about a week before I was able to get it sent home. We generally just moved, and every time we take a sniper round or something, then those tanks and those APCs would just make a turn and just blow the living hell out of all the vegetation for about 100 yards. And
right.
You wouldn't hear anything. We may not have killed the guy, but he didn't want to fire anymore.
Right.
I remember once the APC I was on was detached across a river just to do a little reconnaissance over that side. And my squad was on top of the APC. We refused to ride inside the APCs because if you took a rocket-propelled round, a rocket-propelled grenade round in the side, everybody inside would be killed. Same thing if you hit a mine. So we rode on top. I can remember we're driving along and driving along. It's kind of open. There's a tree here, a tree there maybe, and clumps of little forest and a slight distance. And it's kind of hard not to hear an APC coming. I mean, it's got a great big, huge engine. Sounds like a small tank. And we're driving along, and there's this tree. And we got to within about 25 meters of it. And all of a sudden, a North Vietnamese soldier jumped up from behind the tree and started to run. And the machine gunner from my squad, who had his machine gun just laying across his lap, just kind of turned it over and fired four rounds. And quite amazingly, he hit and killed the guy. Everybody was very surprised. I was on the other side of the APC. I just heard the firing, didn't know what was going on. And anytime any firing took place, the infantry was supposed to jump off immediately and assume a line position slightly in front of the APC to protect it from rocket-propelled grenade troops. The soldiers, enemy soldiers armed with rocket-propelled grenades. But no sooner got in line, looked over, and the gunner, Clark was his name, they went over there. And this guy had been sitting by the tree, and he had a little radio with him, and he had a little rice and the like, and he had some marijuana. And apparently he was just out relaxing from someplace. We don't know if he was in outpost position or just, you know. But still, with that little radio, it didn't have an earplug or anything. How he could not have heard us coming from half a mile away is beyond me. Maybe he did, and he just laid down thinking, well, you know, they got 180 degrees they can go in. Chances of them coming right up to this tree are pretty slim, and then quite to his surprise, here we'd have driven right by the tree and seen him. He should have stood up and surrendered.
Right.
And the direction he took to run in, there was no way he could run and seek any cover or concealment. Because if our gunner hadn't have gotten him, then the gunner on the APC on the left side and probably the front 50 caliber gunner plus our infantrymen, we'd have got him.
Right.
But he took his chance, and I remember taking the body back. I still have a photograph of that. We took the body back so that the platoon leader could check it out and check, you know, documents, things like that.
So you took a picture of the body?
Well, I have a picture of another APC came over. When APCs go through the water, there's this large plank-like that extends forward to form kind of a V to push the water aside as it goes through, and his body was kind of in that V. And I took a picture of it coming across the river. You could just see the body. But there was nothing really on him. He had a wallet and an ID card, which we couldn't read. But that was all sent back to the rear, you know, for intelligence.
Right.
He did not have a weapon, but there were no villages for, you know, God, miles and miles and miles. He was definitely a soldier. Anyway, we continued on, and so finally, of an old fire support base that the 101st Airborne Division had used the year before when they were, or 2 years before when they fought their big battles in the area. And in fact, S.L.A. Marshall writes about a lot of the battles in Tui Wan, that book, Fields of Bamboo, I believe. And then we were, they were left on their own, either the armor was, or they were joined by another platoon of infantry. I was hoping to stay with them all the way up to Chao Rayo, which is the end of the highway, but we got about 20 miles south of Chao Rayo, and it brought us the infantry back. Again, for the rest of the time I was there, it was just, like I said, the same old, same old. You know, patrolling, finding small base camps, finding caches, meeting engagements. We didn't lose anybody killed since, well, since Tet. We had a few men slightly wounded in my company. But we probably ended up killing about 40, 50 North Vietnamese in these small encounters and the like, and destroying a lot of equipment. And then it came, my time to DeRos or to go home was actually late April, but there was some sort of a mix-up. So my orders didn't come in. I ended up spending almost 2 weeks extra in the field. I wasn't supposed to be there.
Right.
Until things finally got straightened up.
How'd you feel about that?
Excuse me?
How did you feel about that?
A little resentful. Thinking, hey, you know, I'd done my time. And I was annoyed with the company commander because I'd approached him. I said, sir, my hero state is up. And he said, well, I haven't received orders for you yet. And I said, well, you know, wait for orders, but why can't I go back into the rear? And I said, well, maybe I can, you know, find out what's going on. And he wouldn't let go on me. And the reason he wouldn't let go is because combat units are always under strength. Always. And he didn't want to let go of a single man. So he chose to keep me. There wasn't anybody I could go to out in the jungle. In the rear, I could have gone to somebody and gotten it taken care of. But you know, there wasn't. It finally came through. I went in. I could have jumped up and down, screamed and yelled like at somebody in the rear, like the inspector general. But I just decided to heck with it. I'm going home. Knew I was coming back anyway. Nothing had happened, so took me a couple days process out, and I left the 90th Replacement Battalion down in Long Bend to go home, flew home. I remember I got into Boston. My parents didn't know I was coming home right then. They just knew sometime. And I hired a taxi to drive me all the way to Ayer outside of Fort Devens. And just knocked on the door on a Saturday morning. My sister answered. Everybody else was in bed. She was watching cartoons.
What was her reaction to you?
She screamed and yelled, went running back in with, you know, Andy's home, Andy's home. It was different. I was glad to be home, but I felt like a visitor. I knew I was going back.
How long was your leave?
30 days.
Okay.
And that did not go against your regular leave time.
Okay.
And also, during that leave, no, that was my second one, I linked up with that friend of mine, and I was watching TV and wearing civilians. But again, most of me was in Vietnam. Watching the news, you know, always wanted to, you know, pay attention there. There was a girl that I'd known in Germany. She was down in Pennsylvania at the time near Scranton, Wilkes-Barre. I'd gotten a Dear John from her in jump school. So I went down to because we'd started writing again when I was in Vietnam. And I proposed, but she said yes. It didn't seem to be overly enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
And during my second time back there, there were just a few letters. And they were just friendly letters.
Right.
So it devastated me at the time. It was probably one of the better things that happened to me.
The fact that she wasn't overly enthusiastic and... In
fact, I didn't get married at 21.
Right.
It was devastating at the time. That was on my second tour.
Right.
Like I said, it was just interesting. I had been out of the country for a long time, even before Vietnam. I'd been in Alaska and then Germany. When I enlisted, I went straight into training, which is a whole world in itself. Mm-hmm. Just so much had changed. It had gone over from the Beach Boys kind of culture to the psychedelic 60s.
Right.
Now, the period that lasted from roughly 65 to 75.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very fascinating to me. Things had liberalized an awful lot. The country was split up, but it didn't really bother me. I didn't see enough. I saw some protests. But they didn't bother me. I knew that I'd seen protests over other things before.
Mm-hmm. This is a month after Martin Luther King was killed. Was there any aftermath of that you noticed?
Excuse me?
This was a month after Martin Luther King was shot in Memphis. Did you see?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. That happened in when I was over there during 173rd. Yeah, that was something else. We were back in a rear area in Tuiwa, and a black friend of mine had got walked over to the PX, and I forget, the unit was back for something. I forget what it was. And we went over there, and we got, you know, whatever little bit of things they offered. And we were walking back, and we were talking, and he happened to notice that the flag was at half-mast.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had already heard of what happened and assumed that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, why is the flag at half-mast? And I looked at him and I said, you haven't heard? And I said, no, heard what? And I said, Martin Luther King was assassinated yesterday. And he stopped, I remember, just stopped dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me real hard and he said, whoever shot him, were they black or white? And I already knew they were looking for James Earl Ray.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, they're looking for a white guy. And he just stared at me very, very hard. I mean, we were generally very close.
Mm-hmm.
And then he just turned and kept on walking. I kept walking with him, but he wouldn't talk after that. I don't remember an awful lot of upset in the unit over that.
Mm-hmm.
It had to have upset a lot of the blacks.
Mm-hmm.
The whites didn't talk about it. Or those that did were hoping that James Earl Ray was caught real quick.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, I mean, went back out into the field right away, and generally it wasn't, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice anything while you were home on leave? Any kind of disruption?
No. When I was home on leave, Bobby Kennedy was shot.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a bus station with this girl I was engaged to when I heard that. That kind of upset me because, you know, President Kennedy, then Martin Luther King,
mm-hmm.
then Bobby Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, gee, what the hell's going on here, you know? People are really starting to get out of control with politicians.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I had my own thing in front of me. And the leave was generally peaceful and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And then went back and I had to go back to the 173rd for some administrative reasons. While I was gone, the company had gotten into a huge battle at a place called Bow Lock, which was over near Bama 2.
Mm-hmm.
And a company commander kind of screwed up. The point team and everything realized that there was an enemy position on this hill, and they had, if the company commander had just swung the unit around to the left and enveloped the enemy mm-hmm. and intact, it'd have been a clear victory, but he didn't. And the North Vietnamese became aware of their presence.
Mm-hmm.
And they got orders, keep going further in, which they shouldn't have. And then all hell broke loose, and they lost, they lost about 15, 20 killed. North Vietnamese lost a lot more. 101st Airborne had to come in to pull them out.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got back, I had heard about that, and I went over to the Tuy Hoa Hospital while I was going through this administrative process and talked to the guys, and they told me about what happened. And then I went back to Tuy Hoa, and everything was straightened, and then I went up to An K, and from An K I went up to the forward base camp at Camp Evans, where I joined the unit at.
Okay.
And I'd say it's probably a good place to stop.
I agree. Okay, good. We'll end it for today then.
Okay.